And then, interestingly enough, a third world war, a Middle Eastern war involving Judaism and Islam and spreading internationally. Well, here's another quote, just in case people don't like that quote. Mazzini with Pike developed a plan for three world wars so that eventually every nation would be willing to surrender its national sovereignty to a world government. The first war was to end the Tsarist regime in Russia, the second to allow the Soviet Union to control Europe, the third world war was to be in the Middle East between Muslim and Jews and would result in Armageddon. Interesting.
This is Bristol. It's Friday, it's 25 past five, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show on the 25th of April 2025, a Friday after Good Friday, streaming live from a corner of freedom close by Bristol City Centre, with my phone going off there, so I'll just turn that off. Thank you very much, sorry about that. And yeah, we've had a bit of a panic getting ready here. Various keys didn't work, so we had two of the three keys we needed to get into where we are today were the wrong keys, and then we didn't have enough extension leads for all the bits and bobs because one of the extension leads wasn't working. So there you go. And also, we got a new sound card which we didn't want to set itself up as nice and easy as we were hoping it was going to. So, hence a little bit of a short delay. Thank you ever so much for anyone that's been hanging on waiting. So we are, of course, in a Templar port, the Temple on Charlie's Empire of Lies. That's called Bristol. La Rochelle's another one. Edinburgh's another one. There are quite a few around. Have a look at the maps of all the old Templar ports. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk screen. UK stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and also live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, which is available free from APK Pure, from the Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. The easiest way to download it is just go onto the website, just underneath the big green download button, there's a link to Nick, the developer's page, where you can find all the latest versions. And he's just had a new update to the app, which has got the new website, the GreenNet website, on the new WordPress, because the old WordPress just started sabotaging us and saying, oh, no, you're going to have to pay. So we have to pay. So if you want to help us pay, you can always click on the little donate button, even just £1 a month. Anything is appreciated very much here. So I'm Tony Gosling. Thank you for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero trust agenda, psyops bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, or boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, basically preparing us for the meat grinder, aren't they, bit by bit? Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers, the World War III and wage slavery. For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, the so-called solutions to multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, migrants, prisons, farming, cost of living, NHS, climate, the twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies are crafted to make every crisis worse. Oh, they're so clever. They think they are, anyway. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment cowards like Curtis Yarvin and his pals, control freaks, want us as slaves to their AI, or maybe just dead. Albert Pike's World War III relies on blind obedience, folks, and you believing that all the fake religions are the real religions. So there's a little lesson for you. Meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist Weth King Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like with the jabs, of your local doctor. But it's not the end of the world, or is it? As we learn, you learn. So helping us navigate the WEF's Fourth Reich is Irish Republican Labour activist, good old Martin Summers, who's joining me here. Martin, this week I think we should probably take a little bit of time out to talk about the big IMF meeting, which Rachel Reeves has gone over to. And I know early this week, we're being told, weren't we, that, oh dear, the British growth forecast is being massively cut back. That was our introduction to the post-Easter world. And there she is sitting in the IMF with a bit of a red face.
Well, it's not just the British economy which is failing. The global economy is basically because of what Trump has done, the IMF have had to massively reduce.
Okay, you're kind of diverting the blame away from Rachel Reeves, aren't you?
Yes,
there?
Because Trump is far more important than Rachel Reeves. Rachel Reeves is a Chancellor of Exchequer in a minor country. Trump is president of the world.
So how is Britain in the League of European Nations?
We are no worse and no better than the other European countries, although, of course, the Germans are suffering particularly because of the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline by the Americans, no doubt with British intelligence involvement. And, of course, that wrecks the German economy. And, of course, that's not their fault.
So there are any questions about Rachel Reeves' ability to do her job?
Rachel Reeves is not brilliant. Rachel Reeves is a dimwit in many respects.
Well, she is very good at running call centres at the Royal Bank of Scotland.
Well, that's all right. Yes, she's not doing a very good job, you are right. But it's a bit narcissistic to focus just on her when we've got the whole global economy going into...
Well, we're sitting here in Britain, which is why I'm focusing on her. And also, we've had some sort of so-called Brexit. Although, I mean, we were hearing from Michael Hudson last week. I know you weren't here, but he was explaining how actually the central banks really control the economy. And as you know, with the Gordon Brown Tony Blair government, one of the first things Gordon Brown did, he said, well, actually, we'll just let the Bank of England control interest rates rather than the Treasury. So the government seems to have ceded most of its control about financial policy, first of all to Brussels years ago, but nowadays with so-called Brexit, even now it's the Bank of England that's deciding many of these things, not the Treasury.
Yes, and that was a decision taken by Gordon Brown. The independent central banks are fairly common around the world because there's an argument in favour of them, there's arguments against them. That's what we've got, and that's the Tories kept the independent central bank. They didn't get rid of it when they were in power. I'll bet you Nigel Farage...
Is it a good idea?
I don't think it is, but that's the reality.
Well, how would you do it then?
Well, having it controlled by the Treasury meant that these decisions were political decisions.
It could even discuss them in the House of Commons, couldn't you?
That's right.
This is what we're planning to do,
everyone
thinks.
But the argument in favour of independent central banks, if people are want to be bored with it, is the point is...
It's not boring, actually.
Well, okay,
but it's kind of crucial, isn't it?
It is.
All of our
futures. The purpose of it, the rational reason for doing this is by taking monetary policy out of the hands of the government of the day, that means that financial services markets, they can be sure that governments are not going to, in order to get elected, spend money that they haven't got and all the rest of it. And that is in many ways, it's a central linchpin of the neoliberal way of doing things.
But I did ask you what you would do. So if the government was in control of financial policy through the Treasury, what would be the levers you'd be pulling right now?
Well, the obvious thing to do is actually use public money to invest in the country and in people. And that's what you've got to do, really. We're not doing it because we've got ourselves tied into this ludicrous idea that we've got to balance the books, otherwise there's going to be a panic.
Well, you and Michael Hudson are quite aligned on all that. He was saying in this excerpt last week, I think one of the best, I had to listen to it about three times before I could get my head around it, but finally he did. And he's talking about this whole idea of modern monetary theory, saying that the last thing in the world you want to do is to borrow from a private bank. You borrow from a central bank where you actually control whether or not you default on your loan or not. This is something very, very simple, apparently, where we could be borrowing from the Bank of England to be making this money up, lending it out at interest. And then if you needed to default on the loan or if you wanted to alter interest rates, you've got a bank which is not at the behest of the markets.
That's right. Modern monetary theory is still controversial in mainstream economics departments, but it's quite widely understood that that is how the economy works. It's basically Keynesianism.
And he's saying
anything you can physically do, you can do, provided you shouldn't make money the problem. If you want to physically do something, say build a load of schools, it's silly to say we haven't got the money to build a load of schools. If you need a load of schools, build them and print the money to do so.
Exactly, through the central bank. And what he was saying was that economists find it very difficult to get jobs and to get work in the universities if they don't get published in there are a handful of these journals around the world that if you don't get published in there, then you don't get a job in a university, and of course all of these journals are controlled through the private sector. They're not actually controlled by governments or by central banks. So anyone who's talking about this modern monetary theory and the idea that you might like to do, as I said, like borrow from your central bank rather than private banks, doesn't get a university job. Amazing, Michael Hudson's managed to hang on to his despite all of this. But this is a complete perversion, not only of the banking system, but also of the whole profession.
Yes, I mean, basically, the economics mainstream profession has become, you know, totally captured by the special interest represented by the financial markets. I was chatting to a guy who's actually an economist at Bristol University in the Watershed the other day. And I was saying, well, you know, do you teach anything outside of the mainstream? He said, well, no, we don't do anything like that. We can't, you know, we've started to chat about sort of non-orthodox economic ideas. And I said, do you teach any of that? Oh, no.
I think, in a way, it'd be quite nice to get Steve Keen and Michael Hudson together to do a little podcast around all these big announcements by the IMF and internationally, because I think both of them together are an interesting combination. Do you know, ideologically, are they quite similar?
Well, they know each other quite well, actually. I mean, it's a small world. If you're a radical economist, there's a small number of people who are in that game, and they all know each other.
Ultimately, Britain is just as bad as all the other countries in Europe. So actually, Brexit didn't make much difference then.
Well, it's probably had a negative impact overall, Tony, but in real terms, the real problems you face, like the Americans blowing up a pipeline, which means you've knocked the energy prices in Europe for a generation, Brexit doesn't make any difference to that one way or the other, does it? Didn't help us.
Quite possibly not. Well, talking about misrule here in Britain, earlier this week I spoke to Dr. David Halpin, who's been looking at, he's actually on a one-man mission to get as many people as possible to put pressure on the Attorney General to actually continue the inquest into the death of Dr. David Kelly back in 2003. Now, looking at this, Martin, it's one of those things that's faded from my memory. Apparently, the inquest into Dr. David Kelly, the government scientist who was mysteriously found dead on Harrow Downhill after blowing the whistle about the dodgy dossier and no weapons of mass destruction being in Iraq, his inquest was opened and adjourned, and it's still adjourned. It's never been completed. Did you know that?
Yes, because, of course, what Tony Blair said is we're going to have an inquiry into all of this, so we don't need an inquest. Because, of course, what the inquest might very well have found is that he didn't commit suicide. But, of course, they can have an inquiry. Oh, he committed suicide. What were all the things about that, blah, blah, blah. So the inquiry was a way of avoiding having an inquest. And, you know, it suggests foul play. Of course it does.
Well, yeah. I mean, an inquest, you have to just have the inquest. You can also have an inquiry, separate inquiry. Why not? No problem, actually. And so I think, wasn't it the Chilcot inquiry was supposed to be the completion of Kelly's inquest? But, of course, it's actually a different kind of legal body that's overseeing
it. I'm not quite sure whether those two inquiries are the same or different. You know, you've got the computer, you could perhaps look it up. I think it's definitely the case. I mean, look what happened with Berezovsky. The coroner's inquest was that he definitely didn't necessarily commit suicide.
It was an open verdict. Where we don't know, you know.
Yeah, that's right. But of course, the British state were very much wanted people to believe that he definitely committed suicide.
Yeah. I mean, all the media coverage of it, saying, oh, you know, he was found with a noose around his neck, blah, blah. Or was it a ligature or something?
A ligature.
Was the idea, was the implication, so he's just killed himself. But of course, he didn't.
Well, yes, that's right. And of course, because he was an opponent of Putin, you'd have thought the fact that there was suspicion of foul play, you'd have thought that the British authorities would be going on, this is terrible, Putin has killed him, blah, 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 blah.
Except it wasn't. What about Sergei Skripal? Is he still alive, do you think?
Well, we don't know, do we?
And Julius Skripal.
John Helmer, who's a British-American journalist based in the US, based in Moscow, actually, sorry, he's done a load of investigation into what happened to Skripal. I mean, many people in Russia think that that he and his daughter have been murdered by the British. That's what they
think.
Why? Because they know too much.
They wanted to go back to Russia, didn't they? Maybe it'd have been better just to get on an aeroflot. I suppose you can't do that, can you? Maybe just, I don't know, find a boat, sail to Russia. just get out of the country. Don't say, I want to go back to Russia.
Well, I mean,
it seems to me, happy to be a victim, if necessary, of Russian justice rather than stay here in Britain. Well, I mean, and he was wanted in Russia, wasn't he?
No, he wasn't amazing. Wanted in Russia. I mean,
I thought he was a spy.
He was a double agent for the British.
If you're a spy and you defect to the other side, you're wanted.
No, he was exchanged in a prisoner exchange.
Oh, was he? Okay.
Yeah.
Right.
So he was perfectly, you know.
He wouldn't have been arrested if he'd gone back to Russia.
Well, no, I think what he was doing was he was sending out feelers to the Russians, say, could I come back? And the Russians were, you know, and don't forget, the timing of it was very suspicious because it was just before the World Cup where Russia is, open to the world. We've got everybody coming to play football.
But he had sent a letter to Putin saying, I want to come back.
Well, I'm not
he
sure.
Has, yes,
okay,
he did,
but the point is, I mean, also
maybe it was intercepted.
Also, of course, there's lots of things that happened. There's lots of things that happened in the hospital where they were being treated, where Yulia basically said that they were sprayed with something in the restaurant.
All of these cases, Dr. David Halpin has got something to say about them because he looks into them very carefully. Strange political deaths, but he's gone back to 2003 this time, and he's asking everybody, if you don't mind, please, to copy his letter to the Attorney General. Just spread it around, because this inquest needs to be completed.
You can help me along by promulgating the posting and by, in fact, broadcasting this interview now. What I must conclude by this, the conclusions that Dr. Hunt made, the first cause of death was hemorrhage from a cut on his left wrist. The second cause of death was the ingestion of cheirodydromol. I forget the picture title now. It was a combination of paracetamol and a opiate, like an analogue of an opiate, dextropropoxifene. That depresses respiration and can kill from that, and it can also cause arrhythmias. So the third cause of death, adding to that, was the possible effect on his coronaries. So they mentioned, Dr. Hunt included, coronary atherosclerosis. The evidence that he gave for that was not great, and many men of 65, whatever Kelly was, will likely have some evidence of arterial disease in their coronary system. I don't think I have, incidentally. So, we have causes of death. The first cause of death is hemorrhage from that. That is absolute nonsense. And that's the key to this case.
Well, look, okay, hang on, David, because I want you, as a surgeon, an informal conversation here. You're not giving evidence at some coroner's court. Who killed him and how did he die?
Who killed him? We don't know. We want an inquest. We want to know whether he was killed or whether it was suicide. The conclusion was that he took his life. That is very much...
Well, I mean, you've looked into this more than almost any other doctor on planet Earth. How did the man die?
If I'm asked to guess based on my professional knowledge, I cannot say exactly what mechanism, but it wasn't through hemorrhage. It might be from toxic injection.
Wouldn't that be picked up by a coroner if he'd been injected with something?
Well, there's something in the... If you look at the post-mortem findings, as eventually revealed in Dr. Hunt's examination. Incidentally, he took the body temperature 7 hours after he arrived at the scene. Taking the temperature fairly promptly does help one establish the window when the death occurred. In his case, the window was expanded quite greatly, partly by this, what I would say was a necessary delay in establishing the body temperature. But in that post-mortem examination, he did notice a little mark inside his right thigh. That wasn't, I don't think, sectioned. If it was excised at the autopsy and then examined microscopically, it might have shown whether there was any needle prick at that site. was one thing. Another thing which was noted was that there was a laceration of his, I think, bottom lip, or top, I can't remember, top or bottom. But I know very well, as a doctor who's attended many people being anaesthetized, that it's very important that when an anaesthetist inserts a tracheostomy tube, that when he puts the laryngoscope down, that the assistant, the ODA as he's called, or she, holds the lip down so that the laryngoscope does not trap the lip between the teeth, causing it to be cut, and therefore causing discomfort afterwards for the poor patient. In Kelly's case, there was a cut on the lip. Mm-hmm. He also had a bruise over his right eye, or an abrasion, I think it was. He also had some abrasions. He also had some bruises, I think, by his knees. The evidence for blood at the scene was minimal. Bartlett, the senior paramedic, commented on that. He had a blood stain over his right knee in the jeans, equivalent to 50 ppt. He had some dried blood on the jacket of his barber jacket and on his wrist. But the assistant paramedic, a lady, name just forgotten for a moment, she was astounded by the lack of blood. And as paramedics, they sometimes attempted suicides when there was blood all over the place, but the patient was surviving. That's my experience as a doctor too. You need to lose almost half your blood volume to die of exsanguination.
There you got it from the horse's mouth, I suppose, because he was one of the first people to make sure that the national press, and they were listening back in those days, make it clear that Dr. David Kelly did not die by slashing his wrists, and it was impossible for him to die like that, to now saying, well, since there's obviously big questions over how he died, let's have a proper inquest into it. And they haven't even done that, Martin.
Well, no, because, you know, that's the way things roll in this country, isn't it? You know, the deep state does what it does. It starts wars, it connives in genocide, and it kills people like Dr. David Kelly.
And here he is explaining about his most recent article, which is asking people to write to the Attorney General, a guy called Richard Hermer, who's from Matrix Chambers. I think there's that Blair's wife's old chambers or something. Handful of people around the temple in London seem to control everything to do with the law, and that, of course, is in that now. This Mr. Hermer, Welshman apparently, Jewish Welsh guy, is now in charge of everything. So anyway, let's have a listen to David explaining what his where his website is, first of all, and giving us a little bit of a rendition of exactly what he's trying to do here.
https://dhalpin, DHALPIN, dot infoaction, infoaction, .org.uk. It's a vast website, and I believe that all of it is truthful. Some of it I would edit for inaccuracy. The title of the posting I'm referring to, I'm going to give you now. It follows the previous one, the title of which is, and it's an important one, The Continuum of Fascism, Part 14, The Gazan Holocaust Grafted Onto a 76-Year-Long Genocide, - in Plain Sight Globally. The title of the one I'm talking about now, A Continued Plea for an Inquest into the Unnatural Death of Dr. David Kelly, CMG, Doctor of Science, 17th/18th, 07, July 2003. That's when he died. The two dates referred to the fact that the window of death was enlarged largely by the delay in measuring his body temperature. And if I could just read out, this is very, very important, actually. I've added my wonderful webmaster, Bill Stevens, has added a paragraph here. This is under three. It's in eight sections, this thing. The last section, eight, as I said, being a personal address to Lord Hermer. This is what I've added, and it's very, very important. there are many pieces of evidence which are, inverted commas, substantively new. This is what they were questioning, the inquest team. And there's many critical omissions of evidence within Hutton, plus the absence of key witnesses such as May Peterson, who translated for David Kelly in some of those 39 visits he made to Iraq under ONSCOM. Add further that his second visit to Iraq after the Holocaust of shock and awe that started 22/3/2003 needs further examination of the colonial court. And I paraphrase, it is what the Iraqis say it is, I paraphrase, machines for making hydrogen for artillery balloons, as reported by Peter Beaumont in The Observer. This demolished the charge made by the US that these two vehicles found by the Iraq Survey Group in May 2003 and much publicized were capable of producing a WMD. This had been predicted by Colin Parr, 65th Secretary of State to the UN Security Council and a packed audience on the 2nd of February 2003. This lie, the casus belli, based on the alleged possession of WMDs, which was backed up by Blair in the House of Commons in the days before the shock and awing, was deflated by this moral man in just two sentences. In fact, it was four. Is this why his life was more endangered? Mackay, who led the survey group, an American, later dismissed as slam dunk such possession, that is, the WMDs. And I have, in a further communication, which I'll send you by email, written again to the inquest team, giving them the verbatim account of what Dr. Kelly said over the phone to Beaumont. That was in June of 2003, and in July, about 4 weeks later, he was dead. I'm quite certain that the sofa cabinet of the paramount psychopath and war criminal Blair, Mandelson, Powell, and the other ones, damned Campbell. I imagine that when they heard what Dr. Kelly had said, they were very disturbed.
There was somebody else, wasn't there, that was also exposing the lies. He was a foreign secretary from 1997 until 2001.
Butler.
No, this is Robin Cook.
Oh, Robin Cook.
He was also...
We know, there's no question that, and in fact we have extra evidence about Robin Cook's demise.
Well, yes, Robin Cook was possibly also done in. I'm quite sure that his wife Gaynor thinks that, because she put on his gravestone... he could not stop the war, but at least he made sure it was debated in Parliament. Rather an odd thing to put on a gravestone, don't you think? And I think she suspects that there was foul play there.
Yeah, so this is all becoming a bit clearer now, isn't it, with this genocide going on. This is all that was, all these sort of things were necessary in order to destabilise the Middle East, to destabilise these various countries, in order to allow the Israelis to do what they're doing today. It all seems to be part of the same plan.
Yes, and of course the 9/11 attacks, you know, the Russian general staff are very well aware about all of these things. The Israelis definitely had an involvement in that, because Mossad agents were filming the first plane when it hit the towers, and then they were arrested. The deep state in the West has been pretty malevolent for a very long time. John F. Kennedy was obviously assassinated by his own security forces, and there's a lot of strong evidence that the Israelis were involved in that. The Israelis aren't the only, you know, they are definitely an accelerating factor, but the deep state in the West has always been pretty brutal. The NATO intelligence services were behind all the Gladio terrorism in Italy and other countries in the 1980s.
But it's okay, we're living in a democracy, Martin. We've got elections.
Well, that's right.
Well, we're not really, are we?
Well, we're not, though. This is the reality is it's a facade behind
Runcorn by-election, and we've also got our very own here in Bristol Metro mayor elections next week.
That's true. But of course, it's a lot of it is for show, as we are speculating here.
Yeah. So in Runcorn, friend of this program, that is, say, Peter Ford, is standing. I mean, he's a deputy leader of George Galloway's Workers' Party. We have him on here quite regularly. He tweeted this week, "How clever of the BBC to let only easy questions through their filter. If I had been able to get through, I would have asked these questions." Now, he is actually, the bookies are putting him down as number three favourite because he was born in Runcorn, as well as being an ex-ambassador. And many of these northern towns are potential wins for George Galloway's party. So he's been put by the bookies as number three most likely to win that by-election. And yet the BBC said, no, he can't come onto the hustings.
Well, I mean, it's an attempt to try and control the narrative, isn't it? We know what goes on. I mean, I was brought up in Widnes, which is on the other side of the Mersey from Runcorn, so I know it quite well.
So what about BBC? What are they up to? I mean, obviously they're trying to fix this this by-election, the BBC, aren't they? Why are they doing that?
Well, what the BBC does is because they're put under enormous pressure by various lobbies, including in the, you know, anti-Semitism lobby and all the rest of it, they
well, it's the neoliberal lobby.
That's right.
It?
They try to be impartial, but they can't quite manage it because they're ultimately under heavy manners. And if they were to be more obstreperous, then they would lose their funding and so on. What happens.
One of the questions Peter poses here is, how comfortable are you prioritising military spending and Ukraine over pensioners and the disabled?
Well, that's a pretty good question, isn't it?
And then he answers it himself in his tweet. He says, are you serious? No person not depraved would prioritise warmongering over the welfare of our own people. So these are the sorts of discussions that are not happening thanks to the BBC. His other question is it right to inflict the highest electricity prices in the world on households and industry as a consequence of net zero? And he answers that one himself too. He says, absolute madness to crucify industries like steel and automotive manufacturing on the cross of net zero. So these are things that don't, I mean, there may be similar questions being asked in these hustings, but shutting him out, I mean, it just seems to me, it's getting obvious really, that the mainstream press particularly, and the government generally, but the mainstream press particularly, is doing everything it possibly can to make sure that nobody puts a cross next to any of the George Galloway Party people. They're actually quite an interesting force in that respect, aren't they?
Well, they are, and, you know, they are part of a general... I mean, there were five independent MPs elected at the general election, including Jeremy Corbyn and various other independents, all of whom were opposed to what's going on in the Middle East. And, you know, there's a groundswell of opinion about that, and the Workers' Party represents a substantial chunk of that.
We're going to be having a listen to Ed Miliband now. Oh, I call him Miliband because nothing he seems to say makes any kind of rational sense to me about energy policy. They're now talking about having higher energy prices in the south of England and lower energy prices in the north of England. I suppose this is because the north is being so deprived by this complete idiocy where all of the energy prices are pegged to the price of nuclear power coming out of Hinkley Point and the new nuclear power station. And the idea is that all of the power has to be as expensive as nuclear power. The market's completely fixed in energy, Martin. That's why we've got the highest energy prices in the world.
The energy prices are fixed. They were fixed by the Americans blowing up the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, which then affects...
Hang on. If they're fixed, they could be fixed down as well as up, couldn't
they? No, they can't be fixed down if they're going to be less than cost of production, can they? Now, what we did have in the past...
Sorry, what do you mean less than the cost of production? These windmills are churning out energy at far, far lower prices than we're paying for it, as are the gas-powered power stations, as are even the solar farms.
Yes.
They're all who owns these renewable and gas-fired power stations is making an absolute fortune because the energy price is so high.
The energy prices are high for a number of reasons. There is the desire to make energy prices high so that you can get net zero. That's one of the things that's going on. But far more important, Tony, is the blowing up of the Nord Stream 2 pipeline. Energy prices are determined by warfare. That's why we invaded Iraq, but to get lower
think,
energy prices.
I don't
prices.
Think you understand how British energy prices are set. They have a central place that sets them, and they're based on the price of nuclear power nowadays. So even if you're generating some quite cheap power, you can now sell it for the price as if it was nuclear.
Yes, and the point of that is in order to try and, as they claim, is if you start moving to renewable technologies, they will eventually come down in price and you will be able to have cheap energy. That's the argument. The real problem underlying all of this is not net zero. It's the war, Tony. The war is driving energy prices through the roof, and that war is underlying it.
The price of energy. I think it's also an excuse that they're using to drive up energy. But anyway, let's have a listen to. We've heard from you. We've heard from me. Let's have a listen to Ed Miliband himself, the Energy Secretary.
And the Daily Telegraph, in particular, reporting that the Department for Energy is poised to approve zonal pricing for energy bills. And basically, my understanding of this, please correct me if I'm wrong, is the closer you are to energy sources, such as turbines, because of the length of cabling, the closer you are, the less you will pay in terms of your electricity, which the implication is that if you're further down south, because there are fewer turbines there, you will be paying more. Your reaction?
Definitely don't believe everything you read in the newspapers. This is something we are absolutely still considering. It's an incredibly complex issue of energy market reform. You're right to say there is this proposal of so-called zonal pricing, or what's called reform national pricing. Here's my bottom line, Negger. I want to do things that will cut bills, and I want to do things in a way that will cut bills fairly. So what I'm not going to do is jack up bills in one part of the country and sort of cut them in another in a sort of postcode lottery. That is not what I am about. That's why I'm taking my time to look at these reforms to make sure that we get these reforms right.
If you said zonal pricing is something that's being looked at, mm-hmm. how would it work if it's not that in one part of the country someone's bills are higher than someone in another part
because
of the country?
Because you could always redistribute the benefits from zonal pricing. If zonal pricing were to cut bills, and if we were to go down that path, you could redistribute the benefits in a way that was fair. So we're looking at all of these issues.
Sorry, I need to be clear in my head.
Of course.
Bills would be different for people in different parts of the country.
Well, here's the thing, just to make it even more complicated. Bills are already different in different parts of the country because of something called transmission charging. So some people in some parts of the country pay more and people in other parts of the country pay less on their bills. It's sort of less known about, if you like. So we're looking at all of this very complex set of things. I'm determined we don't have a postcode lottery, and I'm determined it's fair.
Okay, well, you didn't really explain what they're going to do, just that they're thinking about it. Energy is quite important, Martin, in economics, isn't it? The cheaper your energy, the easier it is for your economy wheels to start turning.
That's right, it's fundamental. And, of course, things like interest rates and the price of energy aren't really set in any kind of free market. When a pipeline is blown up, like the Nord Stream 2 pipeline, that completely affects the price of energy across the board. And that's why we're fighting a war against Russia. We're supporting the Israelis, fighting a war in the Middle East. This is all about controlling oil supplies and therefore energy prices. And it's not a free, it's not a free market where you can just buy what you want from whoever you want. I mean, a lot of energy, for example, is it's piped into your house, and you can't actually. The people who are selling it to you, you haven't got any choice. It's them or nobody.
Taking a bit of a look at, is it Ralph Miliband, who was the two Miliband's father? Can you tell us a bit about him?
Ralph Miliband, well, obviously he's dead now, but he was an academic. He wrote a book called State in Capitalist Society, which came out in 1969, I think. And he was... He was a Marxist, unlike his sons, who are less inclined in that direction.
Right. So um, he's There was an article written about him that is by, I'm just trying to find the author here, Jeffrey Levy for the Daily Mail, and this is all about, this I think is written, this was published around about 2013 when Ed Miliband was leader of the Labour Party and running, you know, this is the way things work nowadays, is it doesn't matter if you fail and lose an election, you're still there. In fact, you're now in power as Ed Miliband is. I don't know how the hell he's managed that, but somehow he's wangled it. But anyway, so this article's about his father. The title of the article is Red Ed, Pledge to Bring Back Socialism as a Homage to His Marxist Father, Ralph Miliband. So you're saying that he's not going to bring back socialism?
No. I mean, when Ed Miliband decided that he was going to stand against his brother,
For
the Labour leadership, he said to his brother over Christmas dinner, it was Chanukah dinner because they're Jews, and he said, you know, if you're not going to apologise for what happened in Iraq, I'm going to stand against you. And David Miliband took the view that, you know, we just need to move on now. It's not, you know, whatever mistakes were made, let's move on. So Ed Miliband stood against his brother, and his mother was asked, their mother was asked who she was going to be supporting. And she said, well, Ralph wouldn't have voted for either of them because they're neither of them proper socialists. So that was her rather diplomatic answer to that question.
It was, yeah. Also, well worth remembering that David Miliband was Foreign Secretary, wasn't he? Robin Cook. In fact, maybe not directly after him, but he was in the dying embers of the Gordon Brown government before the Cameron government in 2010. What we had was this guy was in charge of. Do you remember the Syrian civil war? Some guy was talking about that. I think it was Dumas in France. Do you remember that quote?
Yes, he's saying we're going to have an uprising in Syria. Are you interested? And of course,
he was in London. Just to be clear, this was right. London was organising it. So really, this is David Miliband at MI6.
Yes, and of course, he was very much the establishment's candidate, and therefore they were rather miffed when Ed Miliband managed to squeak home with the votes of the trade unions.
So was he friendly with Netanyahu and the Zionists? Because this was obviously very handy, having a civil war in Syria, very handy for the Israelis.
Well, I mean, David Miliband is now, I understand, last I heard of him, he's working in New York for the International Rescue Committee, Thunderbirds. Yeah, that's what we used to call them in Bosnia.
Who are they? I mean, they're sort of front or what?
They're a non-governmental organisation.
Funded by, do you know?
Well, funded by governments to some extent. They are, you know, they're part of the NGO complex. You know, they're quite a big NGO. They have quite a lot of money. And, of course, they're very in favour of vaccinations, so they take money from Bill and Melinda Gates and all this sort of stuff. At one stage, David Miliband was saying, we've got to intervene in Syria because the kids aren't being vaccinated, as if that's a major, you know, that's the major issue.
The White Helmets got anything to do with the International Rescue
Committee? The White Helmets are a different organisation, as you know, but, again, it's that whole... The West has all of these, you know, the cuts that Trump and Musk have carried out on USAID have exposed massive amount of money they spend on this kind of humanitarianism. So, you know, you've got all of the independent media in Kyiv, for example. The independent media that keeps up a drumbeat of support for Zelensky and support for the war, all funded by USAID. And when USAID was cut, they just had to close all of these news outlets down. But these are then presented to us as independent journalists reporting from Ukraine, telling us about how wonderful the war is and how they're going to win. And it turns out that in actual fact, they're not independent at all. We're using our taxes to pay for
it. It may be that David Miliband's organisation is going into the black at the moment because they're one of the main things that were being funded by USAID, this USAID that's just been cut by Trump.
I don't know the full details.
And he is the boss. He is the chief, David Miliband, of the International Rescue Committee. So these are, this is funded through usually through a foreign office of Western countries, and as part of their what they see sort of see as soft power.
Yes, and of course there will be other, you know, billionaires chipping their money in if they like what's going on. But of course, what happens is things like the white helmets are quite instructive, because the white helmets are, they're not the civil defence of Syria at all. I mean, you know, you don't wear a white helmet to go and rescue people from things. It's just a marketing ploy.
They were the rebels, people.
Yes, that's right. But they were also, yeah, they're the same personnel as Al-Jilani's HTS government now, who were going around kidnapping young Alawite girls and putting them into sexual slavery and murdering those who were not good Sunni Muslims like themselves. But of course, you then have the white helmets saying, "Oh, look at these babies dying. It's all filmed up." But of course, they're actually paid for by MI6, which is actually paid for by us.
Yeah.
And then, of course, we're told, "Look at the poor people in Syria. They're demanding our help." So actually, we're paid for a theatre to take place. Yeah, where we say, we've just been attacked by chemical weapons, except that they haven't, or they're the ones using the chemical weapons. And that we're paying for all of that, and then people think, gosh, we must do something to help the poor Syrians.
Look, back to Jeffrey,
it's all just manipulation of us.
Back to Jeffrey Levy's article about Miliband, Ralph Miliband and Ed Miliband. The quote is pretty damning, it seems to me. This is from Ralph Miliband. He says, "The Englishman is a rabid nationalist. They are perhaps the most nationalistic people in the world. You sometimes want them almost to lose the war." He said this in the Second World War. "To show them how things are. To lose their empire would be the worst possible humiliation." So, do you agree with that?
Well, I'd have to read it through.
I just read it. Do you want me to read it again?
No.
"The Englishman is a rabid nationalist. They are perhaps the most nationalistic people in the world. You sometimes want them almost to lose the war to show them how things are. To lose their empire would be the worst possible humiliation."
Well, I don't know when he said that, but if you say
during the war,
well, of course he fought it in D-Day
actually 1940, so right at the start of the war.
Yeah, well, he fought in the Royal Navy in World War II, and of course the Daily Mail when Miliband was running for,
and he'd just come to London from Belgium to flee the Holocaust. So, yeah. And then he says, "Oh, the British," and he comes out with all this stuff about how terrible the British are.
Well,
and how awfully nationalistic.
Just because he's fleeing the Holocaust doesn't mean he's wrong about the British.
But he wants them to lose. He wants them to lose the war.
Well, no, what he's saying there, you almost want them to lose the war, but so that they understand what the empire. Don't forget, there might not have been a First and Second World War if there wasn't a British Empire. You know, we think of ourselves as the good guys, but in actual fact, that's not how we're seen. All over, lots of parts of the world, we're not seen as the good guys at all, especially now.
Well, I don't know that most people equate British people with the government and the empire. Certainly not now.
Well, it depends where you live.
I don't think so. I think maybe there are some, you know, moronic propagandists in television stations around the world, but the British are not responsible for the empire, ordinary people. It's an elite, and we know an elite.
Okay,
and it's a monarchy. We're in a monarchy here.
Yeah, well, that's what he's talking about. The elite in Britain that run the empire.
Maybe
they need to be taken down a peg or two.
Maybe he's thinking a bit like the Cambridge spies were. About, look, it's our duty to actually do something to break up the class system in Britain.
Well, that's right. And the Cambridge spies, of course, were communists. And they were passing, classified information to the Soviets. Klaus Fuchs came to this country. He was a German scientist. He wasn't Jewish, he was German. And he, of course, you know, basically was instrumental in making sure the Soviets got a bomb at the end of the war. Because otherwise, if we'd been left up to good old Winston Churchill, we'd have nuked the Soviet Union while they still didn't have any nuclear weapons. Fuchs eventually was caught, sent to prison in this country for 13 years, and then eventually he was released and went to East Germany and became a government minister in East Germany. But he didn't regret anything that he did. He fought for Britain in World War II and helped to develop nuclear weapons for the British and the Americans. And he also gave the same information to the Soviets because he was a communist.
So we've also had the death of Pope Francis this week, haven't they? Were you mourning for him, Martin?
Well, I mean, in a sense, because, you know, it's passage of time. He's an elderly chap. He's dead, yes. I've noticed it.
Also, I mean, he was actually quite a political pope, as
they always are.
No, they're not always. No, sometimes they aren't. Sometimes they tend to be... Well, I mean, all I'm saying is he was a particularly interesting guy. I remember reading about the way he was actually... He was in Buenos Aires, wasn't he? He's a bishop and a cardinal in Argentina. And he had been actually quite close to the junta there, to the fascist government. And he actually dobbed in a couple of priests to them, and that they were then tortured. And this was a complete turning point for him. He then turned against the government and managed to get them out of jail. And he became kind of, what his friends said, he became a different person after this whole incident. He didn't realise just how evil the government was, and that just on a casual word from him, that the fascists would use that as an excuse to go and torture people who he felt had really done very little wrong. This is the interaction of the establishment and liberation theology over in Latin America, Martin.
Well, he's got a mixed reputation from what I've read from him. He was regarded really in Argentina itself as probably pro-Peronist. That was how he was remembered by. I saw a guy speaking at the university. He said, "Well, he's basically a Peronist." And other people have said, well, you know, he was also implicated in the dirty war, and perhaps he was too close to the military regime. And of course, he's got relatively liberal social values for a Catholic pope. You know,
a Catholic pope.
Well, unlike Cardinal Ratzinger, for example, was very, very, you know, stuck to the,
anyway, Sky,
the traditional
Sky News,
teachings.
Sky News did quite a good little thing about some of the milestones in his life. Let's have a listen to that.
Let's take a look now at some of the key moments in Pope Francis's life and his time at the head of the Catholic Church. He was born Jorge Mario Bergoglio on the 7th of December 1936 in Buenos Aires, the son of Italian immigrants to Argentina. He became a priest in 1969 and later the Archbishop of Buenos Aires. On the 21st of February 2001, he was made a cardinal of the Catholic Church and told the faithful not to travel to Rome, but to celebrate him by donating to the poor. After Pope Benedict stepped down on the 13th of March 2013, Francis was elected Pope by the conclave after just one day, aged 76, the first from the Americas in the Southern Hemisphere. He chose to be named after Saint Francis, known for his frugal life. Pope Francis made his first visit outside of Rome to the southern Italian island of Lampedusa during the migrant crisis. Later, in 2016, he visited the Greek island of Lesbos, famously taking 12 Syrian migrants back to live in the Vatican. In August 2018, he visited Ireland, where he made a plea for forgiveness and sexual and institutional abuse committed by the church, and held a summit in Rome on the issue.
So there you go, she finishes there on the point that he's actually trying to address this head on, some of this institutional abuse as well, which other popes have swept under the carpet. Another thing to say about him is he refused his salary. He had about, apparently, when he died, around about $100 in assets. Yes, obviously he had the papal expenses, the papal expense account, but he was a frugal guy, Martin.
Well, yes, I mean, you know, I've heard that said of him, yes. I mean, you know, I don't know what else to say. I mean, he's got a reputation of being, you know, for example...
Well, it's quite nice to have somebody who's in a very high-profile position like that, who's actually a really decent... And you could almost say he's somebody you could just have a kind of chat to. He was kind of normal rather than some kind of power freak.
Well, I mean, he also spoke out about the Palestinians, for example. But some people will say, well, he didn't speak out enough. Other people will say he spoke out too much. I used to work for CAFOD, which is the Catholic Fund for Overseas Development.
Did, didn't you?
And what you've got in the Catholic Church is a fairly big split between what you might call the liberal-minded liberation theology Catholics and the more conservative, you know, we want the world to be like it used to be, Catholics, you know. Ratzinger, of course, was a German and very, very conservative. You know, he didn't like, you know, opposed to any kind of you know, social movements in the developing world or whatever, you know.
The other thing about Francis, of course, is he was from Latin America, which had never had a pope from over there before. Absolutely fantastic. I think fantastic guy, you know, very nice bloke. But Martin, you mentioning CAFOD there. CAFOD, I always remember someone telling me years ago, when I was doing journalism up in London, oh, CAFOD, well, it's just a bit of a front operation, really. So apparently they do some good stuff, but they're also used as an NGO to get money through to all sorts of, you know, potential dodgy groups. So is that true, do you think?
No.
Would you like to fess up to
that?
Well,
I mean, obviously, I don't know everything that they do in every part of the world, but certainly I wouldn't say that at all. I mean, they're a pretty reputable development charity. Most of their money comes from people who go to church, Catholic churches. They do get some other money from British government, from the Overseas Development Department, as most of these organisations do. But of course, the thing about the CAFOD is that they don't actually have they don't have hands-on workers who go. What they do is they work through local partners. Yeah, so they find local partners to work with in different parts of the world.
So they sort of tap up some local that they think is kind of pliable, yes, and compliant, and then
they try to find
the money to them.
Well, they're trying to find people who are trying to do things and need money. But of course, that's a bit of a hit and miss thing. Sometimes the money goes. I mean, when we were working in Bosnia and Yugoslavia, a lot of the money that we got was spent basically on food aid for people in camps.
Okay, so none of it went on arms.
Well, you don't know, because in actual fact, you see, the food aid gets moved around, and it gets moved around in trucks, and those trucks can have arms in, and you can't check it all the time.
No.
And that's not your fault if that happens. It's just one of those things. Are we going to feed people or not? Now, in war zones in particular, it does get very messy. Yeah. Because if you're trying to get aid through, you might have to negotiate with somebody to let it through. And they may say,
anybody with half a brain knows that the Catholic Church were very helpful to the Nazis, particularly at the end of the war, in helping them get out of the country, providing these rat mines.
Yes, and that would be Ratzinger's people. Yeah. Opus Dei. People like that.
The Knights of St. Columba.
Indeed, all of that. Whereas CAFOD are very much from the other end of the spectrum. They are your liberal
Catholics.
Well,
it would be very interesting. They've had this film called...
not many Tory votes.
A feature film called Conclave, haven't they, out last year. I remember being recommended that by Chrissy Hine from The Pretenders, saying, hey, really good film, folks. But she obviously didn't say it like that. Hey! No, she didn't say it like that either. Stop it, Tony. But it's a great little film. Have you seen it?
No, I've read about it, but I've heard...
Well worth it, I'd say. I mean, you know, as modern films go, which are mostly pretty rubbish and actually badly directed, badly edited, you know, one of the things I really hate about these modern films is the way they cut like crazy. Even the Bond films, they're not... You know, what you do is you do a nice crafted long shot where you've got two or three things going on and then you cut again. But you don't just keep cut every 5 seconds, which is what so many of these modern films... Conclave, well made. Decent film, so well worth a watch, and very current. And the most interesting thing, of course, about Pope Francis was his immense support for the Palestinians. In fact, in his very last ever message on Easter Sunday, he was talking about Palestine, Martin, wasn't he?
Yes, he was. And some people have been saying, well, he could have done more, he could have gone to Palestine. But on
I don't think he was in a position to go very far, was he, actually? No. Anyway, let's have a listen now to Sky Report on Pope Francis, and we're hearing now a recording of one of his chit-chats he would have with a Catholic church in Gaza, apparently every single evening.
It is hard to find a place of peace in Gaza in the middle of this war. But here is one. The Holy Family Church in the north of the Strip. Gaza's tiny community of Catholics attended Mass to mourn the loss of Pope Francis.
Yusuf.
A Pope who called them every day, even from hospital.
Sto bene, grazie a Dio. Mi scusa, è stato con la Santa Messa.
Ah, con la Messa. E dimmi, sì. Cosa avete mangiato oggi?
He lifted their spirits at a time when Gazans feel abandoned by the world. Pope Francis was outspoken on the war. In a statement on Easter Sunday, he called for a ceasefire, for the release of hostages, and aid for the, quote, starving people of Gaza. He also said unarmed civilians are targets for bombs and gunfire. The last call the church leaders received from Pope Francis was on Saturday night.
More than 1 year and a half, and he called every day, every day. He asked to us to help the people, to protect the children. And so, in the name of the Lord and the Church, we try to continue to give this message of peace, of justice, of protection for every human being.
Pope Francis supported Palestinians, prayed for them, and urged them to be strong. He also condemned rising global anti-Semitism and called for peace between both sides.
We received the news and were in a state of great shock because the Pope was checking in on us daily. He doesn't just ask about the Christians, but about the Muslims as well. He asks about Gaza as a whole.
There was a special bond between Gaza and the Pope. These nightly calls of comfort. A connection to the world. A smile. A laugh.
Bye-bye.
Hope when all feels lost. Nicole Johnston, Sky News, Jerusalem.
Yeah, using quite a lot of Sky News. Sorry, folks. I've been doing that the last couple of months, actually, because they do seem to be doing a far better job than the BBC. It's annoying. This is an American company. I think it's called Comcast that owns it. But it's still, I think Murdoch has still got shares in it, but he hasn't got control. But they seem to be doing a lot better job than the BBC. But, I mean, the main thing about this, Martin, is that we had here somebody on the world stage who was speaking up for Gaza. And the contrast, of course, is with the Church of England, who don't seem to be doing so much. The Catholic Church do.
Well, I think...
Neither, so. Probably enough.
Well, yes, I think... Well, I've been on a protest in Britain, in Bristol, where a priest for the Church of England, an elderly lady, gave a very good speech just before Christmas. I think what you'll find in all churches, especially the big and mainstream churches, is there's a spread of opinions. Some people want to go to church because they really just want to hear
the vicars and the preachers just want to avoid it. They don't want to talk about Gaza. They don't want to talk about Palestine in their sermons or in their... They may say, oh, if we're all victims of war, you know, in their... in the prayer part of the service, but they seem to be most of the churches seem to be, just like during COVID, avoiding any kind of implications that there might be about lack of civil liberties, and particularly to do with the Holy Land, because it's seen as controversial and they don't like controversy.
Well, some do and some don't. You know, Reverend Sizer has been defrocked effectively by the Church.
Maybe that's why they don't.
That's the problem.
Because they'll be bullied out by the Church hierarchy. The thing is, they won't be bullied out by the Church hierarchy if Pope Francis is in charge, will they? So the Church of England is really rather different. Also, look at the head of the Church of England, King Charles. Let's have a listen to his he didn't do a kind of read it out thing, which we can play to you, but it was a written one, what is becoming now an annual Easter message, as he does everything he can to sort of increase the amount of time people have to listen to him. So King Charles's Easter message now.
The King wrote, "One of the puzzles of our humanity is how we're capable of both great cruelty and great kindness. This paradox of human life runs through the Easter story and in the scenes that daily come before our eyes." He added, "There are three virtues that the world still needs, faith, hope, and love, and the greatest of these is love." Releasing an Easter message was something he started to do as Prince of Wales. Now, of course, he takes on the responsibilities of monarch. But their arrival wasn't welcomed by everyone. Shouts of "Not my king" mixed in with the cheers.
Down with the crown! Down with the crown!
Things have certainly changed since his mother's reign, just like his decision to release an annual message to mark this time of year.
Thank you, Charles. Good to meet you.
words that he hopes promote love and acceptance, whatever your beliefs may be. Rhiannon Mills, Sky News.
Dying with the crying, they chanted. So it's a big puzzle, apparently. That's the Easter message, Martin.
Well, it's just boilerplate stuff, isn't it? I mean,
but it ain't a puzzle. It's a battle between good and evil. And he doesn't seem to get it.
Well,
he doesn't get it, does he?
Well, I mean, he's got his own opinions, just like you've got yours and I've got
mine. Which side is he on?
Well, he is who he is, Tony.
He wants to chat with Zelensky, doesn't he? Let's have Zelensky up to Sandringham. Let's feed him some nice cakes and stroke him.
That's right, but that's because that's the whole establishment in this country are bought out in that direction.
No, he has to do that because the establishment tell him. No, he does exactly what he wants.
Well, he does, but he actually agrees with the establishment about this. He agrees with Kemi Badenoch. He agrees with Keir Starmer. He agrees with Sir Ed Davey.
Yeah,
they all love Zelensky. All of them. It's crazy, but there you are.
It's not that crazy. Zelensky's making money for somebody, and also, of course, he's getting up the nose of Putin. As we know, that seems to be the main driver of much of our establishment in Britain is people they don't like. We don't like them. Let's just make their life hell.
Well, that's right. It's getting rather confusing now because we've basically subordinated ourselves completely in Europe and in Britain to US policy over many, many years. And then the US just turns around and changes the policy without bothering to consult us.
Of course, we're in a
messy situation as we speak.
We've got to the King condemning Hamas as terrorists, as he did at the Queen's speech or the King's speech to Parliament, we also have British MPs who are going over to the West Bank to have a look. And this is one of their little reports they did.
We have seen the checkpoints increasing its frequency and its numbers. So a half an hour journey is now taking people 4 hours on average. But one really disturbing feature that we saw was whole towns being gated off indiscriminately without warning. So we ourselves witnessed one town as we were driving with an occupancy of over 40,000 people. There was a gate just across it, and people could not get on either side by any form of transport. You don't know how long that gate's going to be there. You don't know when it's going to open. You can imagine as a child, it takes so long to get to school anyway. With the advancement of this gate, it means you can't take your family car. You have to find public transport on the other side of the motorway. A whole wedding had to be cancelled because there was no way for the groom to go with the wedding guest. This is a daily occurrence for them. This constant humiliation. You've got these gates, you've got the walls, you've got these sophisticated routes and pathways, you've got this very difficult situation of working in certain areas, schooling in certain areas. It's apartheid in everything but name. We saw firsthand aggressive colonizers, and it was absolutely shocking to experience. And what was really alarming is many of these Israeli settlers not only work with the protection of armed police, they seem to be working in collaboration with armed police. Then we were in Hebron, where we were being hosted by an individual who, after the October 7th, was taken for 12 hours, tortured, sexually abused. And his house now is in the middle of neighbouring houses whose houses have already been taken over by settlers. So whilst we were sitting there, two Israeli settlers came, said, look, you might as well give us this house because we're going to take it anyway because God has given it to us. This was not just bravado. There was two soldiers standing there pointing guns.
Well, I presume these are Labour MPs, are they? That have.
I believe so. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, I mean, they're dispassionately reporting.
I believe it is an independent MP. But what they've done is they've come back to explain all this. So God gave us this land, so the settlers just get out, and if you don't get out, we'll force you out.
Well, that's right, and it's totally illegal under international law. So any armed resistance to that is legal. All of these settlements in the West Bank are justified in terms of Israeli internal law as being necessary for military reasons in order to keep control of the territory. Now, that means that those settlements are military settlements. They may have women and children in those settlements, but you shouldn't put women and children in a military base, should you? And then if somebody comes along and starts killing those people, they are absolutely within their rights in international law. They are. And of course, that's a lot of what the Israelis are doing is in complete defiance of international law. If their name was Slobodan Milosevic, they'd already be dead and their state would be liquidated.
Do you support Hamas?
I don't support Hamas because I live in Britain. And I just not for me to decide what people in Palestine
vote for. It's a bit of a trick question, that, isn't it? A bit of a naughty question.
Do you support Likud?
Oh, I'm not saying anything.
Well, there you are, you
see. Of course,
all of those people that say about Israel got a right to defend itself, they are supporting Likud. So Likud are terrorists. Likud bombed the King David Hotel. They killed Lord Moyne. They killed loads of Palestinian civilians at Deir Yassin. They are terrorists. So Keir Starmer and all these other people who are in favour of the state of Israel.
King Charles.
And King Charles, they should have to justify that. Yeah. Why are you in favour of terrorism? Don't ask me about Hamas until you've justified your support for Israeli terrorism.
So answer the question. Do you support Hamas? Do you support Hamas? Summers, do you support Hamas?
They are the elected government of Palestine.
Anyway, I was trying to trick you, which is a bit mean. But anyway, there is a case going forward now in London, which is an attempt to deproscribe Hamas. And here's lawyer Frank McGuinness, who is one of the lead lawyers, who's trying to make sure that this absurdity of an elected government of Palestine being proscribed, so you're not allowed to support it, which is giving the police loads of pathetic excuses to go and harass people and harangue people just for standing up against the genocide.
It's worth noting that the military wing was proscribed more than two decades ago in 2001, shortly after the Terrorism Act 2000 came into force. And then fast forward to 2021, the political wing was proscribed. Now, of all of the many, many reasons, and many of them are set out in detail in the application we've made, and people interested can read that application by going to hamascase.com. So you can read it and make up your own mind. Some people may disagree with some of the arguments we've made. Some people will disagree forcefully with the idea of making such an application. But what's important is that people actually engage with what's quite a serious set of arguments. But in my opinion, the strongest argument is the argument from peace. If you actually want to see peace in Palestine, you need to talk to people who win elections. And we learn a lot from history in general, but from specific examples in history, such as the South African apartheid example and the example of the British colonization of Ireland. It was only by talking to organizations with which the British government profoundly disagreed that peace was eventually achieved. And so it seems likely that in this case, the alternative to talking to Hamas, certainly talking to its political wing, which has been winning elections since 2006, the alternative is a genocide, right? So a part of the argument we're making in the application is that by almost blaming the entire people of Gaza and arguably the entire people of Palestine because of the political choices they make at the ballot box is an integral part of the logic of a genocide. And by continuing the deprescription, continuing to treat Hamas as an illegal organization, the British government is, that's part of the British government's not mere support for, but participation in this ongoing genocide of Palestinians.
I mean, the application, as you say, you can get it online and it's very detailed and thorough. I mean, I urge everyone to look at that. How long did it take to put together, if you don't mind me asking? It must have been a really long process.
Yes, absolutely. The lawyers, so there's three lawyers, a solicitor, Fahad Ansari, and then my colleague at the bar, Daniel Gruters, and I. We worked on it for more than a year. And it's worth noting that there are 20 experts who also provided reports, right? People like Professor Avi Schleim at Oxford, with whom I'm sure most of your viewers will be familiar, formidable anti-Zionist, and Professor John Dugard, who is, of course, one of the most renowned international lawyers of his generation. So they submitted expert reports in support of the application. That took a lot of time as well. It's fair to say that it was an extensive amount of work went into producing the application. And it's not just the 100-page submissions that my legal colleagues and I have drafted, but it's the accompanying witness statements. So two witnesses represent Hamas in these proceedings, as well as I've said, the 20 expert reports. And so in total, the application and its accompanying witness evidence and its accompanying expert evidence runs to 600 pages. So some light bedtime reading. But for those willing to make their way through it, I hope it does provide context and a perspective that is very rarely they say about themselves, their commitment to accountability, their commitment to the laws of war, their willingness to be held accountable in respect of allegations made against them, it's a very comprehensive document, and I do encourage your listeners to engage with it. Like I said, hamascase.com has all of the pleadings. You can download them, and I encourage people to engage with it as much as they're able to.
Okay, so that is Frank McGuinness, a lawyer for hamascase.com. Do you stand much chance, do you think, Martin, in forcing the British government to de-proscribe Hamas?
I don't know, because I don't know whether... I think that the politically, the people like Morgan McSweeney, who are around Starmer, will be totally opposed to it. But I think it's a very necessary thing, because the whole idea of what's been going on is we've got to get rid of Hamas. That's like saying we've got to get rid of the elected leadership of a country. It's like we've got to get rid of all of the elected leaders of Israel. They've all just got to go.
Maybe
they've
we could proscribe the United Russia Party.
Well, that's effectively what we've done. I mean, this is what happens. And, of course, David Miller has been cancelled from his role as a professor of Bristol University.
Sociology.
And yes, all these people go on about how they feel as if the woke brigade are trying to silence them. It's people like David Miller who are being silenced. It's us that's being silenced.
Meanwhile, back in the UK, I think this is always useful and interesting to look at the effect of the Israelis on Britain, because as you probably remember, a few weeks ago we had Joe Banks in here explaining how this hideous student block, which is the tallest bit tower block ever to be built in Bristol, right by the St James Barton roundabout bear pit at the bottom of Gloucester Road here, is funded through Israeli money, the same company that's built a place for the IDF to train to kill people in Gaza for urban warfare. And so the Israeli tentacles stretch a long, long way back here. It seems to me that by having a success, any sort of success that they do have over in the Middle East, the Israelis are empowered to take over more and more over here in the UK. And that's clearly happening in the National Health Service. This is Vanessa Beely now talking about just how this company Telias are now getting into something called genetic based mental health solutions here in the UK and winning NHS contracts.
New UK-Israel collaboration to bring innovative mental health treatment solutions to the NHS in the UK. And at the bottom in the small print, it basically says grounded research team at Rotherham, Doncaster, Southumber, NHS Foundation Trust, groundbreaking collaboration with Israeli digital health company Talias. Now, Talias is effectively the developer of the Predictit app or system.
Meet Talias, tailoring the right treatment for each individual. A groundbreaking genetic, clinical, and demographic-based tool designed using a unique and sophisticated platform of predictive machine learning algorithms. A unique tool that has been validated against the world's largest data sets. Here's how it works. A DNA sample is taken from the patient in a simple and painless process. A number of background questions are uploaded to the cloud, and the Telias tool goes to work. The data goes through cross-analysis using prediction algorithms based on countless comparisons between genetic and clinical data of patients around the world. Within a short amount of time, a recommendation is received on the most suitable treatment for the individual. This is how healthcare should be. Telias, tailoring the right treatment for each individual.
It's fast-tracking to medication based on your DNA results. And worth noting, your demographic factors also are being factored into the final medication prescription. And the fact that DNA is then being stored on the cloud that is also being operated by effectively an Israeli company that is managing the UK Ministry of Defence, Ministry of Health, and so on. So let's have a look again at how it works, just for people to understand it. So first of all, you'll have a digital questionnaire. Note that you're not expected to go in and actually talk to somebody, which in many cases would actually resolve any minor mental issues that you might have. You then have the genetic test, which is an odd naming of it or labeling of it, which again will collect your DNA through a cheek swab. And this decides if you are predisposed to mental health issues. So in other words, you might be given medication even if you are not currently suffering with mental health issues. In my opinion, that's how I'm interpreting this. Then the personalized report, which will give the results digital or in a personal consultation. So finally, we get to hear about a personal consultation. And then effectively prescription, precision medication prescribing, the tailored treatment and dosage for your patient. But do they actually need that medication? Then it goes on to explain step into the future of mental health, prescribing with Predictix, Predictix in your clinic, improve patient care with better clinical outcomes. Well, I'm not sure that's the case because, again, there's no personal interaction at all. Optimize time and clinical efficiency. So this is all about optimizing time and efficiency. It's the disintegration of the mental health system, just as we've seen the national health system being also broken down. Increase in revenue with superior outcomes. What on earth, what bearing does this have on successful treatment of mental health in the UK? And it claims to be HIPAA and GDPR compliant.
So Vanessa Bealey there speaking on the UK column. Israelis seem to be very, very advanced in these tech firms and promising all sorts of things to do with, oh, it's okay, we'll just take a blood sample, check your DNA, and we will have a mental health solution for you.
Well, it's one of the only major industries they've got in Israel is this high-tech, defence sector. The 8200 squad or whatever it is, their version of Brigade 77. And, of course, what it means is they get their fingers into all of this data all over the world. And these people are supposedly private sector, but not really private sector. They're embedded within the Israeli military industrial complex, which of course gives them massive power over population. They're trying to control the population.
People at the national who run the National Health Service or work in the health service even realize that the money for patients and for wards and this sort of thing, basic stuff, is being channeled into these kind of digital solutions and DNA solutions by Israeli tech firms.
Well, Wes Streeting, who is the health secretary, is all in favour of, we've got to reform and modernise the health service, and this is the sort of thing he's talking about. And, of course, what we really need is just more money to be spent on the basic stuff.
Okay, so as we wind towards the break, finally on Gaza, I think it's finally, we go to Lebanon, but we don't, actually. We go to here in the UK to... Bridport, is it Bridport? I think it is, on the North Devon coast, and to a little laboratory out the back of a house owned by a certain Dr. Chris Busby, because he's been getting samples brought back to him from Lebanon to examine. And this is the dust, Martin, I don't know if you've been following any of this, and the dirt from around the attack on Beirut, which killed the leader of Hezbollah, Nasrallah, before Christmas. So the idea is, let's have a look at this dirt, and what he's found in it is uranium.
Yeah, so in other words, they're already using low-yield nuclear weapons.
No, not really, because uranium could easily be depleted uranium, yeah, which is a form of toxic radioactive waste. Yeah. So when you enrich uranium, as they keep talking about the naughty Ukrainians doing, and that means that you can then start to use that U-235 in a reactor or in a bomb. As you start to enrich it, you get the U-238, which is the depleted uranium. Now, this is a waste product from enriching uranium, and it's been used for many years by the British Army and by the United States and others, Martin, hasn't it, as in tank shells, because it can penetrate armour better than steel.
Yes, and in both Iraq and in Serbia, there's evidence to show that massive increases of cancers where they've been using depleted uranium shells.
So what it does is it creates a really toxic environment wherever you use it, and that it could possibly never be cleaned up. But anyway, here is Dr. Chris Busby for altogether about 7 minutes, taking us through what he's been doing with this dust. So he doesn't want to say too much about how he get hold of it, because you can't just obviously stick a bunch of dust in the post and hope it gets to Devon. And so he's had a particular chain of how would you describe
it?
Custody, correct. Right the way from Lebanon to the southwest of England, so that he knows this is the genuine material, and he's got then he puts it through these various processes to figure out whether or not there's uranium in it. And this is how he found, yes, there is. So the Israelis are almost certainly now, it's known really, using depleted uranium at the very least weapons over there.
There's a sample. That is an actual sample. That is one of the three samples. This reddish soil. You can see, I don't know if you can see reddish soil, but that's what it is. And we put the plastic on top of that and shut this down. And that keeps out the radon. There's a lot of radon in the atmosphere. And the radon in the atmosphere clearly affects the signal. And so you have to put another piece of plastic in there which is not close to the soil. And that's your control. So then you can measure the number of decays on the plastic that's not the control and compare it to the number of decays that you get on the sample itself. And of course, if the sample is sitting on some hot particles, so there's lots of material here, but somewhere there is a hot particle, here it is, you get a lot of tracks in one place. See that? That's what we see, which I showed you before on the screen. So the reality is really a result, or not the reality, the result is what you get when you do this experiment. So we take this CR39, or this thing, once it's been sitting in there for 30 days, and we pop it into concentrated sodium hydroxide, in this case potassium hydroxide. Here it is. Very, very powerful, dangerous stuff. It would burn a hole in you very quickly. It's probably the worst thing that you can get splashed on you. It's much worse than sulfuric acid. Anyway, so you have to be a little bit careful. But anyway, I'm a chemist, you know, from long ago, so I am a little bit careful, although I will say I have blown myself up a few times. And so you put that into a beaker of this potassium hydroxide, and you heat it up to 80 degrees with this hot plate thing, which you can control with a rheostat, so you can make sure it is 80 degrees and it doesn't go up and down. You know, you can alter the... This is a voltage conversion thing called a rheostat. So it turns 240 volts into 230 volts or 220 volts or 180 volts or whatever. And so you can figure out what level of voltage you need to put into this to get the right temperature. You can get machines that do this automatically, but I don't have one. This is Chinese. Costs about 30 quid. So there we are. So then you boil it up. Then after you've boiled it up, had it in there for five hours or 4.5 hours at 80 degrees centigrade, you pick it out with some tweezers. There we are. See, got everything here. There's the tweezers. You pick it out with the tweezers and you wash it off with water. And then you dry it. And then you stick it in a microscope. Well, you've seen what happens when you... I mean, I was at the other microscope is the little Vickers, which has an overhead illumination microscope. This is an inverted microscope. You can use this, or you can use an ordinary microscope, which one of those is phase contrast microscope. It's an old Olympus microscope from long ago. So you don't need stuff that's terribly expensive. I mean, you can't get this thing for nothing, but basically it's not terribly expensive. And the result is what I showed you. You see, extraordinarily, that these samples contain these hot particles. And not only do you see that, but we discovered that the particles produced an impact on the underneath of the plastic plate. And remember, this is sitting on top of the sample. There's the sample, okay? So the plate's sitting on top of the sample. And there's sample all around it too, like you see in the dish there. but somehow particles, hot particles, appear on the top of the so when I turn it upside down, you see, this is the bit that's facing the soil material. See, here's the soil material in there, and this is the bit that's facing the soil material. Imagine, well, I'll show you, but there it is. So there's the soil, you can imagine it's in there, and there's the plastic piece of CR39 sitting on top of it. But of course, all the time that it's in there, the hot particles are coming up out of the soil sample, and because there's a lid on it, they haven't got anywhere to go. See, I mean, if this wasn't on there, of course they'd go into the desiccator and wander about and stick on the walls or whatever. But I can't look at the walls with a microscope, you see, but I can look at this thing with a microscope. And I had this on top. This was unexpected, incidentally, and very interesting and important. So what we found is that these hot particles turned up on the opposite surface of the plastic, which meant that they came up and they went down like this. And of course, because when they're inside the matrix and they're in the soil, they have to break out through the soil. So some of the tracks that you get are a little bit sort of wongly because they must hit a soil particle and bounce off it, you see. So they're not all in the same place. But all of the tracks on the top were all absolutely clustered together, which means that the particle was a pure uranium particle or maybe uranium-235. We don't know. It may have had plutonium in it or whatever. But anyway, it was probably a pure uranium particle which... U-238, U-235, U-234 particle sitting that had come out of the soil and dropped down on the surface, on the opposite surface. And the image that we got was fantastically good. So that's how we did it. So let's pull this all together. What is it that we've done, and what is it that we know, and what is it that we've discovered? Well, what we've done is we have looked at three samples from the site where Hassan Nasrallah was killed following a bomb by the Israelis on the bunker where he was. And the samples that we obtained from there have shown the presence of uranium particles. So that's the first thing that we've done, and I think that's quite important.
That's Dr. Chris Busby. Is he a nutcase?
No, obviously not. And of course, he's discovered previously, we've had him on the show, haven't we, talking about how he went into Gaza and got hold of soil samples from there, and there was evidence of neutron radiation, otherwise neutron bombs had been used as part of the ongoing process of the Palestinian genocide.
So, does it matter if the Israelis are using these depleted uranium shells to bust their way into underground bunkers? I mean, it's the obvious thing to use, really, isn't it?
Well, they shouldn't be doing this at all, because it's not their country. They shouldn't be there, and they shouldn't be killing people there. The way in which they do it is also important, because, of course, depleted uranium is banned, just like white phosphorus. But they don't take any notice of things like that, do they?
So, do you think this is pretty conclusive?
Well, I mean,
what I'll obviously do is I'll put the video up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. You can watch everything that he's doing there. I was thinking it's a little bit like a sort of kids' TV program, sort of taking you through how you do some sort of silly experiment. But obviously, this is deadly serious, and our governments are not doing this. Some kind of quack scientists down in Biddeford is.
Well, that's right, because it takes people with that sort of... eccentric point of view to find out these things. I mean, no doubt the British state could be finding these things out for itself, but it doesn't want to because we're basically in the pocket of the Israeli government.
So, ode for this week, delays, forays, dark days of death. Due process cries from those who pose with stench of death in the nose. Israel hell beg time to prize the evidence before our eyes. Omerta rule in demon's lair. Intimidation everywhere. The truth is out, streamed on our screens. Genocide, a horror scene. New ruling from the ICJ.
for Zionists to have their way. 6 months delay so they can vet the genocide they have beget. No time will cover up the dead, nor paramedics shot in the head. Vans in sand buried deep, time reprieve, more death will reap. Games of evil genocide, Israel the front, US to hide. Funnel bullets, bombs and guns, Israel hell to kingdom come. Pope Francis dead, God bless his soul, with bruise on face, the truth ne'er told. His love for Gaza daily gave, demise, how odd, now in his grave. Unspoken words, silent threats, infiltration, truth, see vet. Human rights, 191, justice gone, now on the run. ICJ, ICC, now hand in glove with all we see. Offers made, can't refuse, death or life, each must choose. Ho Vienna, pilgrims come, where Jews and those of faith succumb. As one with God, humanity, to stop the genocide we see. Oppose the cult of Zionism, no more hold hostage in their prison. Human race, stand steady, do. Oppose the Zionists, all who, like plague, invade with putrid breath, as one resist this cult of death. Thanks very much for that, Patricia. So we'll be back in a minute after the break. We'll start with a very nice little Easter hymn.
Christ in your native covered with green. Mesmerized children now playing, meant to be seen but not heard. Stop me from dreaming, don't be absurd.
a bonfire. Enrico plays with it. They probably will in games without frontiers or without tears. If looks could kill, they probably will in games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears. Chiang Ching's is blue. They all have hills to fly them on, except for Lin Taiyu. Dressing up in costumes, playing silly games, hiding out in treetops, shouting out rude names. Tears. If looks could kill, they probably will. In games without frontiers, war without tears. Games without frontiers, war without tears.
So that's Peter Gabriel from, what year is that? 1979, one of his first singles that he did. I think Sledgehammer was like later in the 1980s. Before that, we had Entangled from Genesis, which is Peter Gabriel's written song, which is all about the sort of psychiatric system, which is kind of weird. I love it. 1976, and before that we had Christ Be Our Light, which is what we were singing here, not here, but it was what we were singing in church on Christmas Day. Lovely. And for some reason a Catholic hymn. I've never really worked out why that is a Catholic hymn and not a Protestant hymn. Anyway, thanks very much to particularly to Peter Gabriel for that lot. And welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show with Irish Republican Labour activist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Martin, we're going to start part two by looking at this, first of all, this assassination of a Russian general over in Moscow today.
Well, I saw about this earlier, and of course Kirillov was also assassinated with his bodyguard some while ago. Of course, he's the head of the chemical and biological warfare troops. I don't know who this guy is. Presumably, the Ukrainians are behind this, no doubt being helped by British intelligence people. And, of course, generals are fair game in wars.
Okay, so there's the... There's the United States sending over their... is it a foreign secretary or whatever? He's
Witkoff. Just a personal envoy.
Steve Witkoff over to. So who's done this? And what, is this?
I imagine that it's been carried out by the SBU, which is the Ukrainian secret services, but they work very closely with MI6.
I suppose the idea is to disrupt this meeting between Whitcliffe.
Yeah, I think what it's about, because
Putin and
don't forget, the British and the Ukrainian government do not want a ceasefire. They do not want the war over. So by carrying out acts like this, it keeps the war going. I doubt whether it was cleared with the Americans. Certainly the SBU working with the British, and the British and the, you know, basically taking control of Zelensky and his acolytes. And they are, for reasons which I cannot understand, the British are particularly keen to carry on fighting Russia in the Ukraine, even though there's no percentage in it for us whatsoever. All we're doing really is aiding the Americans in their reckless policy of wrecking the global power structures, but there we are, we're doing it.
So let me just spell it out for you, Martin. A car bomb has killed Russian General Yaroslav Mushkalik near Moscow. A homemade, they say, explosive blows up in a parked car, a Volkswagen Golf, killing Lieutenant General Yaroslav Mushkalik. But who is this guy? Authorities named him the deputy head of the main operational directorate of the military's general staff.
Well, he's a senior guy. Kirillov was assassinated because he presented the United Nations Security Council with all the evidence they've gathered from the biolabs they captured in Ukraine for the deliberate development and deployment of COVID-19. So everybody in Russia will be aware of this, and of course in Iran they're very well aware that the head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard, Salami, said that COVID was a deliberately created bioweapon at the very beginning.
So you're talking about Kirillov. There's also a whole string of high-profile wartime assassinations. Ukraine usually denies a role in attacks within Russia or Crimea, but its officials often celebrate them on tweets on X, etc. So back in November, senior Russian naval officer Valery Trankovsky was killed in a car bombing in Crimea. In August 2022, Daria Dugina, the daughter of Russian ultranationalist Alexander Dugin, was killed in a car bombing. In April 2023, pro-war Russian blogger Vladlen, let's pronounce his name right, since the poor guy's been killed by a bomb, Tartarsky, he was killed in a bombing at St. Petersburg Cafe in a present which was given to him, which then blew up in his face and killed him by some girl. And in July 2023, submarine commander Stanislav Rychitsky was accused of war crimes by Ukraine, was shot dead in a park in Krasnodar. So this is going on quite a lot, isn't it? Like,
yes.
Literally assassination after assassination, and another one today.
That's right. And of course, what the Russians might do, I don't think they are going to do, is maybe there should be some car bombs for British generals
now, you know,
who are driving to the Golf Club.
Well, this isn't happening, isn't it, so far? So this reminds me very much of what's going on down in the Middle East. So what we've had is a succession of these Israeli assassinations of Hamas leaders and Hezbollah leaders. So the same sort of tactic seems to be being adopted by both Israel and by Ukraine.
Yes, and of course in Syria there were Ukrainian operatives working with Jelani's people to do, you know, to make sure that their drones were up to scratch when they were overthrowing the Assad government. They seem to have got the idea that if they can hit the enemy leadership cadre, that they're going to win. I mean, this
or cadre.
Is cadre, or whatever you want to call it.
Cadre.
You know, they've been trying to kill the Houthi leadership in Yemen, the Nasrallah leadership. And, of course, if they do attack Iran, it will be a decapitation strike. They'll be trying to kill the president, the top people.
And this is the sort of thing that the West has been doing for quite a long time. Do you think the MI6, CIA, have been involved in this killing today in central Moscow?
I think it's quite likely the FSB will conclude that MI6 are involved. That means your taxes have been used for that, folks. It's inside Russia proper, so it's an attack on the Russian state inside Russia proper. I don't think the Russians are going to do this, but what they might do, and they would be within their rights to do, they could kill a British general. Yeah, because it's only a small place, Britain. I'm sure they can find one.
But the idea is that I think it seems to me that these sorts of assassinations are designed to escalate a conflict, a war, so that there's more aggression on the battlefield. Seems to me that the whether it's the Lebanese or Hamas or the Russians, they are absolutely adamant. They don't want to escalate things, so they're not going to do these sorts of assassinations.
Well, I think that's not their style, because, of course, what if you were to go tit for tat, let's say the Russians were to kill a British general in Britain tomorrow as a retaliation, would that solve any problems from the Russian point of view? Not really. I think the way the Russians operate is they do carry out assassinations, but they're carried out very surreptitiously and in ways that they can't.
I'm not so sure they do. I think they've decided that the way that people are promoted in the West to key positions is so utterly flawed and ridiculous. In other words, basically friends of friends, maybe members of the same Masonic lodge also, you know. But anyway, the point is that the people who are doing the appointing are appointing sycophants to these roles. So there wouldn't be much point in assassinating incompetent sycophants who are running the opposition, would there?
No, there wouldn't. And in any case, obviously, what the Russians are trying to do is they're talking to the rest of the world, the South Africans, the Brazilians, whoever, the Chinese, and saying, well, they do that sort of stuff, but we just concentrate on winning the war on the ground. I mean, they've killed quite a lot of NATO personnel inside Ukraine. So this attack in Sumy last week, which killed a load of, there were a load of NATO military personnel there. And they've made it clear that if anybody from NATO who's in Ukraine, you know, helping them fight, we are going to make it a priority to kill you. And they've killed quite a lot of quite senior NATO personnel inside Ukraine. But they haven't done it elsewhere. That what's significant about all these attacks is they're happening inside Russia proper. And, of course, the Russians could say, well, we could carry out attacks in the United States. We're going to do that. Because they can. They could, if they wanted to.
So, the other various aspects of this story, Russia is saying Putin and Witkoff meeting is making progress. And Trump, this week, has told Putin to stop after strikes on the Ukrainian capital. So we do tend to get the news, don't we, like we had yesterday, oh, the Russians have struck Kyiv. But they don't talk about why the Russians have struck Kyiv. So the Ukrainians hit into Russia, Russia retaliates, all we get is a news story about the retaliation as if it's come out of the blue. So what is going on?
Well, the Russians for a long time have been taking out military targets in Ukraine, and that includes things like electricity substations, railway shunting yards, factories.
Military award ceremonies. That was one that's over right. Easter break.
Right. The local MPs, for Ukrainian MPs at Sumy, were complaining that they shouldn't have had a military award ceremony 20 kilometres from the front line. So they gathered all these people together to give them medals, and they brought their families with them. And the Russians just put a missile on it and killed a lot of them. Because, you know, if you're going to have gather all your generals together and all your top boys...
In the open air, yeah.
Well, no, you're going to be a target, aren't you? And, of course, they targeted it and they killed them with collateral damage. But, I mean, it's horrible. This war should never have started. But, you know, that's what wars are like.
Do you think there's any prospect of this ending? Trump is telling Putin to stop?
No, I can't see it happening. The Russians are basically trying to be seen to be reasonable. So if you want to talk to us, we will talk.
They did have a one-day Easter truce, but
it was ignored. The Ukrainians ignored it.
Yeah, but the only thing I saw was loads of questions about accusations that it had been violated by the Russians.
No, what happened was they said, we're going to have a 30-hour truce, and the Ukrainians just ignored it. So that's because don't forget the Zelensky regime and the people around him, they cannot have peace because there's potentially he's going to be killed by the ultra nationalists. And of course the British are playing a particularly idiotic role in encouraging the Ukrainians to dig their heels in and make as much fuss as possible to prevent any kind of peace developing.
Okay, over to Kashmir now. And there was a bizarre attack. 26 tourists were shot dead in Kashmir. which is this disputed territory. It's actually part of India, but it's a majority Muslim, majority Pakistani. So this was a great little nightmare, hornet's nest, left by the British at the end of the British Empire. What do you make of this? The something called the Resistance Front, the group which has claimed this deadly attack.
Well, I don't know who they are, obviously. We're sitting here in Bristol, thousands of miles away.
We have you here because you've got a bit of insight.
Well,
into
I'm not psychic, and I can't.
It's a little known armed group that apparently that emerged in the region in 2019. It's claimed responsibility for the attack, which 26 tourists have been killed, more than a dozen others were injured on Tuesday. Armed rebels who've been fighting for Kashmir, a secession from India, largely spared tourists from their attacks in recent years. It doesn't seem that this can actually do a great deal for their cause,
well,
does
I mean,
it?
Yes, but it may well be, because what's happened now is India and Pakistan are now facing off along the line of control in Kashmir and elsewhere, so they've already opened fire on each other. You have to ask yourself who benefits from this, and it's unlikely to be the secessionist movement in Kashmir. It's just, you know, Modi's now in full warpath mode because all of these tourists and middle class Indians from all over India visiting Kashmir, they've all been killed. It now behoves on him to do something about it.
Now, India and Pakistan both nuclear.
Yep.
Armed states.
Yeah.
And I haven't seen reported anywhere else, is the Indus Water Treaty, which has now been suspended by India. Pakistan has said this is, for many years, has said this is one of our red lines. If they suspend this treaty, that's an act of war. And
that's
it could potentially be a nuclear war.
So in other words, this attack, whoever carried it out, is potentially creating a war between India and Pakistan, which we don't really need. Frankly, people, we don't really need such a war. But there we are. We could have another war on our hands of potentially catastrophic.
What annoys me about the mainstream press is it doesn't take much, doing to say, well, hang on a minute, this treaty, if they suspend the treaty, which they've now done, you've potentially got a major war on your hands. Now, India and Pakistan have been squaring up for many decades, haven't they?
They have, and also there's been attempts to try and mediate and try and get some solution to this Kashmir issue. The fact is, most people in Kashmir who are Muslims
let them have a vote.
Ah, but if they did that, they might vote
India. They would go to Pakistan, wouldn't they?
Yes, that's the problem.
Well, fine, let them do it. You don't have a war.
Well, no.
So maybe by not doing it, you really want is a war.
No, but also you've got to accept that the establishment in India, Narendra Modi in particular, they've got a fairly robust, aggressive stance towards neighbouring countries, you know, like Sri Lanka, for example. So there ought to have been a solution to this years ago. There should never have been a conflict in the first place.
Well, like I say, let them have a vote, and then they can decide. But, you know, what's happened is over the years, there's been all sorts of people, the Indians particularly, have been putting all sorts of people in there. So injecting large, to try and change the demographic. Anyway, this is a sort of thing the British, of course, will be doing for many years in Ireland, funnily enough. And of course, this was a British country, India, which was split off into India and Pakistan and Bangladesh. But anyway, let's have a listen now to someone that really does know what's going on. At least I hope he does, if he's not working for MI6. That is Adil Raja, former Pakistani army officer I spoke to yesterday about this attack.
Unfortunately, whatsoever the Indians are saying at this particular time, they are correct. Why? Let me tell you. Taking you back from where you asked this question, so I was linking this Balochistan incident, the train hijacking incident. Now, the Pakistani military, which is already, which is not respected at all, not worshipped the way they used to be for 75 years. They're in fact hated in the country because of their crackdown on dissent, political dissent, because of their crackdown on people of Pakistan who support Imran Khan, because of jailing Imran Khan and his party members, and because of the atrocities and extrajudicial killings of journalists like Arshad Sharif in Kenya. Because of all their actions, because of this fascism by the Pakistani military, they are not being liked is a lighter word. They are they're definitely being hated right now in the army, so they need to redeem their reputation. And there is no better way to redeem their reputation than to start a war or to utilize the anti-India hatred. So that is the underlying reason. But the second major reason was that the reason why this Kashmir attack was sold to the Pakistani military establishment was that said that, listen, it is the Indians who are supporting the Baloch insurgents, the insurgents in Balochistan. So we need to send them a message by supporting insurgents in Kashmir, by separatists in Kashmir, because we need to tell them that there is going to be a price to be paid if you're going to support the insurgents or the separatists in Balochistan. So that was how this thing was sold, and it was definitely, as by my sources, and I've got my colleagues there in the Pakistani intelligence community, they say that it was the Pakistani army chief, Asim Munir. Asim Munir ordered this operation in Kashmir, this attack on tourists in Kashmir. He ordered it, and these were the proxies, these were the elements which are based in Pakistan, whose leadership is based in Pakistan. They've always been there, you know. It's been an open secret, and they've been attacked, and there have been skirmishes, and there have been so-called surgical strikes before this. So the same elements were used to launch this attack in India, in which unfortunately 26 tourists were killed. And before being killed, they were, the saddest part is that before this incident, just a week before this, the army chief Asim Munir in Islamabad, he gave a very fiery speech, which is uncalled for. This is the army chief in uniform addressing the entire nation on national TV and saying that, listen, he gave an anti-Hindu rhetoric in his speech. And he gave a very heavily religious fundamentalist sermon. And he tried to rally the Muslim fundamentalist support for himself. And because he want to portray this image of a macho man, and he needs that image because he considers, he wants to match the popularity of Imran Khan. I mean, the previous army chief tried that as well, and he's trying that as well, but it's not going to work till the time there is no war, and till the time the entire nation, because of the nationalistic tendencies in the war, they rally around the army, and well, he in cash. Encashes upon that. So 1 week after him giving that speech against the Hindus, the people, these tourists were attacked, who were, mind you, and the Indians are going to collaborate this, and if you just do a bit of research, you'll know that their circumcision was checked to know that whether they're Muslims or not, whether they're Hindus. If they're not circumcised, they were shot. That's how they checked them, whether they're Hindus or they're Muslims. And that's how they were shot. And my sources say, they claim, and they are credible sources, we've been proven time and again. That's why my credibility got established. That's why I've got this all this support, because whatsoever I say, it becomes a reality. The proof is always in the pudding, which comes forward in a bit later. But I've been quoted quite extensively about this, but my sources in the Pakistani intelligence community say that it was an operation which was authorized, given greenlit by the Pakistani army chief, General Asim Munir, and the ISI orchestrated this attack through their proxies, and they've got no shortage of proxies. And it was a message sent to India that if you're going to support Balochistan, we are going to open a front inside the India or in the areas where you've got trouble. And there are so many areas, so many separatist elements there in India as well. So the proxy war has been reignited because the military is desperate to redeem their reputation, one. And secondly, they want to impose a penalty on India for supporting insurgency in Balochistan.
Well, no, it's a fascinating analysis. But you know what? You can imagine people at the ISI saying, well, our deal, he's just working for RAW. He's working for the Indian Secret Service.
Yeah, Tony, they say I'm working for the MI6 as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's hilarious. But how would you answer that?
The thing is, the proof is in the pudding, you know, as I always say. And whatsoever I've said, my sources in the ISI, these are the people who do not agree with the policies of the army chief, Asim Munir, who is always, prioritizing his personal interests over the national interest. And because of that particular reason, there is a political instability in the country for 3 years continuously. And that is why the people's mandate has been stolen, has been proven. In fact, that's why the Pakistan Democracy Act is there in the US Parliament. The main opposition, the Pakistani military junta right now, they've got is in the overseas Pakistanis because they've cracked down on dissent domestically. But the overseas Pakistanis, since they're well read, they've seen the world, they're well traveled, they know, you know, what's really going on in Pakistan. They've seen democratic systems, so they're challenging their rate. So whatsoever I've said has always, you know, it's been proven right, firstly. Secondly, there's a history to what I'm saying. The ISI has been conducting these operations. It's, you know, it's not that this is the first time. Then the present army chief, who is under whose orders allegedly this attack has been conducted, once he was himself the director general of the ISI, the previous mega attack was conducted around 4 years ago in, it was in Pulwama. And, you know, there was, again, a warlike situation between India and Pakistan. So at that time, the same army chief was the director general of the ISI. And, well, this modus operandi has always been there. The people, I mean, Indians are openly carrying out assassinations of the Kashmiri leaders, of the Khalistani leaders on the Pakistani soil.
I mean, what you're saying is this is an attempt to take the fight to the Indians, but then I can also imagine that since the ISI has got all its business interests, actually war can be very good for business too, can't it?
Yeah, that's true. They've planned it very well. The plan is the first casualty of war, and they've ignited the war, and now they're panicking, and now they want to... their media cells and their media assets to, you know, blame the Afghans for whatsoever has happened there. They're saying, well, blame it on the Afghans. We really don't want to take it any further. Why? Because the Indians have, instead of attacking Pakistan, because they were ready, you know, the Pakistanis did it. Another proof is that even a few hours before the attack, the Pakistani defense were on highest alert. They were ready. They were expecting an attack. And another proof is that their attack was, they were on such a high alert that they're, just early morning today, they have, yesterday, in fact, they had captured an Indian border security force, Booby, who is trapped by them. So he just crossed over while walking, he says, to the Pakistani side, and the Pakistanis were on the high alert and they have arrested him. And they're now with he's now with the Pakistanis. So the Pakistanis were ready for any attack. But what the Indians instead did was that they're the upper riparian state. And there is an Indus Water Treaty, and Pakistan is a heavily water-stressed country right now. And there is a huge political issue right now in the province of Sindh, which is towards the Indian Ocean. They're not getting their due share of water from the Indus, and there is an Indus Water Treaty, you know, brokered by the World Bank, which ensures that Pakistan gets its fair share of water.
Yeah, well, the Indians are now in the process of cutting that off. But look, I just want to ask you...
Yeah, unilaterally suspended the Indus Water Treaty. And now, that's funny, Tony, because as per the Pakistani nuclear doctrine, if the Indus water stream is cut off, that means that the Pakistani nuclear threshold has been crossed and they are going to launch a nuclear strike.
Well, look, let's hope they don't. I just wanted to ask you finally about the involvement of the Israelis, because I've noticed, say, for example, in Myanmar, Burma, that the Saudis have been funding the Rohingyas and the Burmese army has been being funded by the Israelis. So there's this interference in a lot of countries, which are Muslim countries, with the terrible twins of Israel and Saudi actually fueling these conflicts. I wonder if there's any of that going on, to your knowledge, in Pakistan, India.
Well, Tony, yes, but the theory goes that the Mohammed bin Salman, the Saudi crown prince, was about to accept Israel diplomatically, but the Pakistanis have to agree to it. And Imran Khan was the prime minister at that time. And Imran Khan said absolutely not, because there was a political decision. Imran Khan refused. And that is what contributed towards the regime change operation of Imran Khan, because the Pakistani military junta, which are the real power brokers in the country, they wanted diplomatic relations with Israel. And the proof is that recently it has been widely reported in the media as well that the Pakistani delegation, a highly powered delegations of Pakistan, they've been been visiting Israel since, even though Pakistan does not accept Israel diplomatically, but they traveled to Israel through UAE by sponsored by an Israeli NGO called Sharaka, right? And it's based in UAE as well. And well, there are allegations that were funded by Mossad. I don't know about that. I asked them directly. I wrote an article about them. They didn't care to respond. So I mentioned that as well. But the Pakistani military establishment wants cordial relationship with Israel. And they are, you know, striving to create some sort of a bilateral relationship. And as for the policy, you know, spelled out by Sharaka, they say that in the next decade or so, we see ties normalizing with Pakistan because they want to, you know, maintain diplomatic relations.
Well, this is another reason, of course, why Imran Khan has been shut out. So we've only got half a minute. Can you just let listeners know whereabouts they can find you and follow you, please, Adil?
Yeah, so you can follow me on the X, formerly Twitter, at Soldier Speaks. You can find me on Substack on soldierspeak.substack.com. And you'll find, if you want to follow me for my private vlogs, I am on Patreon as well, patreon.com/soldierspeaks. And my website is soldierspeaks.org.
Adil Raja, thanks very much for joining us.
My pleasure, Tony. Thank you.
So there you go, from the horse's mouth, from former Pakistani army, also based in London now. Do you buy that, Martin?
I found that very interesting because he's obviously got inside information which other people aren't going to have because of his ex-military. So I think what's significant there is I was thinking, well, maybe this is the Indians messing around here, killing tourists because they, you know, then they can make the insurgency look bad and all the rest of it. And it might be Modi behind it. But he's quite clearly saying, no, my inside information is the Pakistani military were behind this, and he's linked it to what's happened in Baluchistan previously, which again will be with the Indians and Western powers messing with Pakistan to prevent the Chinese Belt and Road Initiative stuff that's going on in Baluchistan. And you can see how volatile the world is, where when something
two
happens,
nuclear powers
that's not just there. I mean, just think about all the different factions in both India and Pakistan who are manoeuvring. I mean, the world, it's a very dangerous time.
Yeah, so
the
who is
world.
It that's writing the script for this general, this Pakistani general, going on TV, doing his Ian Paisley?
Well,
you know,
I mean, presumably he's strong
Indians.
Enough to write his own.
It's a bit worrying, isn't it? When you get, I feel like sort of Oliver Cromwell or whatever. When you get a military leader, a dictator, effectively going on some sort of god trip.
Well, the point is that the military are, in fact, quite just, you know, they've removed Imran Khan to keep the Americans
like,
and the British
like
happy.
Netanyahu,
yes, and but at the same time, they've got what they may want inside Pakistan is more military confrontation with India, because then they can discipline their own
population.
Yeah, well,
that's pretty much what he's saying, isn't it? The other thing is they're trying to blame it on the Afghanistanis, the Taliban. That's what apparently some of the press in India. Sorry, in Pakistan, are trying to do, and the generals. And Adil has tweeted just a couple of hours ago, 4 hours ago, in fact, there goes the plan of the Pakistani military establishment, he says, to blame Afghanistan. because in an encouraging development, the Taliban have sided with the tourist victims in Kashmir, have denounced this terrorist attack. Pakistan, India, USA, Afghanistan. That's the Times of India reporting that. So, you know, that's...
Yeah, well, I mean, the Taliban are the government in Afghanistan, so they're obviously going to potentially say, well, we did nothing to do with this. But you've got various factions, all sorts of militant factions operating in Pakistan and Afghanistan.
So they use all these cricketing metaphors, you know, as they're chatting, saying they've knocked the Pakistani military's establishment's efforts to blame Afghanistan for a six.
Yes, well, I mean, that's one of the things that they India and Pakistan share, is a passion for cricket.
And isn't it awful the way that that Imran Khan is being treated? I mean, this is obviously, you know, this is a military dictatorship now that we're dealing with over there, and they've got nukes, another one, like the Netanyahu and his nukes.
Yes.
Oh, hang on, no, that's a democracy.
Yes, well, they're not supposed to have any nukes, though.
Okay.
That's illegal.
Supposedly, yeah. Anyway, let's have a listen now to one of the main features for this week. I interviewed a guy called Don Jeffries. He is a US author. He's written lots of books. His main one, which was very successful decades ago, is just simply called Hidden History. Funny, isn't it, that we have had all these Todd Ryder Hidden History things on over the last few weeks. But that's nothing to do with me contacting Don. I initially got hold of him because he's done, I think, an excellent article about the use of fear. It's looking at war and COVID and all these sorts of things. But anyway, he, then the longer interview, by the way, there is a longer interview with Adil Raja as well, which I put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, where he talks about, you know, kind of how he's wound up in London and what a lot of his influences are, as well as all the details about the ISI and how they operate, the Pakistani Intelligence Inter-Services. What's it called?
Inter-Services Intelligence.
Yeah, that's them. And so that will be up at thisweek.org.uk later. But as we're a longer version of this interview we're about to hear now with Don Jeffries, his Hidden History really drills back into US history. And particularly, he has a right bugbear about a guy called Abraham Lincoln. Now, do you know anything about Lincoln, Martin?
I've come across the name.
Yeah, so he was the president during the Civil War, I believe.
He was, yes.
And he was on the side of the evildoers or the good guys?
Well, he was the leader of the northern states. Most people listening will know who he is.
The northern states being the, not the Confederacy, being the, what they called the Union in the Civil War. So anyway, he really has a bit of a downer on Lincoln, and he's about to explain why now.
I basically wrote a Hidden History 2, which is Crimes and Cover-Ups in American Politics, 1776 to 1963. That's kind of the prequel to it, and it goes back to the beginning, to the War for Independence, and all the way up to the Kennedy assassination. And Ron Paul, the great Ron Paul, wrote the foreword to that. I was, you know, incredibly honored. He's been a hero of mine as well. And that was the book where I really, I think, exposed a lot of readers to the truth about Abraham Lincoln. And I convinced a lot of people, I think, that, you know, this guy was our biggest tyrant, not our greatest hero. So we looked at FDR differently. We examined
Come on. Let's hear a bit about naughty old Abe Lincoln.
Yeah. Well, again, it goes, and I, you know, Lincoln was a hero of mine too before I, but you know, I, when you look at the actual record, you realize, wow, this guy, he, everything, all the problems we have in, not all, but most of the problems we have in America today with this tyrannical authoritarianism, this overreaching government, comes from Lincoln. Lincoln, you know, all the presidents before Lincoln, except one, Polk, who invaded Mexico, and that was not good. He overstepped his boundaries. But every other one, no matter what party they were in, they knew the limits of their constitutional powers. Lincoln did not. He thought he had unlimited powers, and from the very get-go, I mean, he suspended the writ of habeas corpus, which nobody had ever dared to do before. So when you look at the January 6th prisoners, obviously, you know, all those years later, 160 years later, whatever, Lincoln set that precedent. Because we still don't know how many thousands of Northerners he threw into prisons, to makeshift prisons, for just opposing his policies. And they had no charges against him because the writ of habeas corpus had been suspended. So you had people spending time in prison, dying in prison, for no reason at all, because they opposed his policy. And it was like a hysteria, you know, so your neighbors could report you for some, you know, really stupid thing, the way you held your hand or something. And the troops could arrest them. People were arrested in church. They were arrested in the middle of the night. Their homes were broken into. So the story of it is in my book. And I was influenced by Professor Thomas DiLorenzo, who wrote The Real Lincoln and Lincoln Unmasked, and did a great job showing that. But Lincoln shut down over 250 newspapers. The point was, the entire war was unnecessary, because if he had just let the original, and it's what's important to remember is that when we fought, you guys know we went against England, but with the reason we wanted to secede from England. That's what we wanted to do. And the Confederacy in America, they call themselves the Confederacy for a reason, because our original document was not the Constitution, it was the Articles of Confederation. So they chose that name for a reason, that, hey, we're going to go back to what we were supposed to be. They thought the Constitution gave the government too much power. A lot of people still feel that. So when they wanted to secede, the southern states said, we no longer want to be a part of this union. Lincoln should have just said, I mean, look at what Thomas Jefferson wrote. Whenever the people, tire of this kind of government, they have the right to alter or abolish it. And the idea that we were founded on as an independent nation was the consent of the governed, that all people have a right to consent to those who govern them. In 1860, obviously those Confederate states no longer consented. So when Lincoln said, no, you can't leave, this is not a voluntary union, you do not have the right to consent to those who govern you, he shattered the foundation of the American Revolution. And the conservatives, especially Republicans, worship this guy. Oh, my God, Honest Abe. And by the way, Honest Abe, the reason he was called Honest Abe is the same reason you would call a bald guy curly. He was so dishonest that his critics called him Honest Abe. So that's, again, this hidden history. And people think, oh, he was so honest. No, he was not honest. He was he was so bad. This guy was a stooge. Huey Long, my hero, he famously said, I never would take a case against a poor man. I don't think Lincoln ever took a case for a poor man as a lawyer. He was a tool of the railroads and corporate interests. And he actually, believe it or not, great emancipator, he actually defended a slave owner when he was trying to get his runaway slave back. Now, how many Americans do you think that would think, oh, my God, Honest Abe, of course, would defend the runaway slave. He's the greatest. No, he defended the slave owner.
So, hey, hang on. This is a bit like Mark Lane defending the Nazis.
Mark Lane did.
So, I think it's useful because in the UK, sometimes the whole idea of a war of independence and a civil war kind of blend into each other. Right. The 18th century blends into the 19th century and we get a bit fuzzy brained about the United States, but you're quite right. The War of Independence we were just hearing from Michael Hudson recently on our show here that war was about money. It was about the United States' ability to rely on and print and control its own money system, the colonial money system. Whereas the British wanted to impose their system on the United States, and that was what really was at the fundamental back of the War of Independence. But the Civil War, this, it seems to me, was, I mean, you please do correct me, but it seems to me was a lot to do with the concentration of power in Washington that a lot of people in the United States weren't happy with. We're sold this kind of lie. It's very interesting talking about all this stuff because we were just saying about the Kennedy assassination being about Cuba. Maybe it was actually really about Israel. And maybe that's this whole idea of concentrating power in Washington was really what the Civil War was all about. It was nothing to do with slavery.
No, I don't think it was. And if you look at Lincoln's record, first of all, Lincoln gave speeches in his 1858 Senate campaign against Stephen Douglas. He gave speeches that would read like something the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan would say. And that's no offense to Lincoln because, to be fair, 99% of the white people back then believed that. They would be considered, that's just the way the world was. They considered themselves superior. I mean, these beings were slaves, so of course they felt they were superior to them. So Lincoln was no different than that, but he didn't become enlightened. In his first inaugural address, I think he mentioned the word slavery twice in the entire address. And he said, if I could say, he says, my job is to save the Union. And he said something, I don't think I have any right to stop slavery where it's at. I have no authority to do that. That's what he said originally. And of course, he very famously said, I just want to save the Union. If I could do it by freeing all the slaves, I will. If I could do it by freeing some of the slaves, I will. And if I could do it without freeing any of the slaves, I will. But a couple of years into the war, it wasn't going so well because the South had much better, tacticians. They were some real military strategists in the South, and the North did not. They just had an advantage in numbers. He decided to go to try to get sympathy of England and France and the rest of the world. He suddenly turned this into a moral crusade against slavery. Then suddenly it was about slavery. And then towards the end of the war, he suddenly, Lincoln, the evidence is, most of the evidence is that Lincoln was an atheist. And in fact, there's evidence that Lincoln in his youth was such an atheist that he wrote a rebuttal to the New Testament or something. And his friends found out about it and got him to burn it or something when he was going to enter politics. So you can't have this out there on the record. So Lincoln, there's no evidence really that he believed in God, but he started talking about God a lot near the end of the war and blaming God for the war. He took that tact, the Almighty wants us. The only way the sins of this great land can be purged is through blood, of almost a million people. So I can't say enough bad things about Lincoln. The more I read about him, because the guy just, he set so many bad precedents. So the precedents he set of locking dissenters up who had committed no crime and were not even charged with any crime, they would be, Woodrow Wilson, another horrible president, would be used to do that in World War I when you had lots of people, anti-war protesters, like the great socialist Eugene Debs and others, Joseph Kennedy Sr., who was John F. Kennedy Jr.'s, John F. Kennedy's father, who was a great anti-war protester in World War I and World War II. He didn't lock up Kennedy, but he locked up a lot of people, and the Supreme Court ended up ruling that he could do that, and most people don't know that. I found that out when researching that book. That's where the asterisk on our First Amendment comes from, that you've heard that you can't yell fire in a crowded theater. That came from the Supreme Court ruling of Oliver Wendell Holmes, great liberal, eugenicist, pro-war guy, who used that as an example of why Wilson could lock up anti-war protesters. And I pointed out, however you look at it, protesting a war is not yelling fire in a crowded theater. But the average American doesn't know that. They just nod their heads, and it's like, that's where that comes from. So Wilson used Lincoln's precedent to do that. And then Roosevelt, FDR, probably the only president that can match Lincoln in terms of being awful. And again, that's why the court historians love him. Roosevelt locked up a bunch of people that protested the war too, and also incarcerated not just the Japanese, but Germans and Italians as well in concentration camps in America during World War II. Stole all their property. My latest book, American Memory Hole, tells how they stole billions of dollars of homes and businesses from these people and never gave it back after the war. They just absolutely stole it. But Roosevelt used, again, he used what Wilson had done as the president. Wilson used Lincoln. And we go even to George W. Bush, in the early 2000s, his attorney used Lincoln's incarceration of Northern prisoners as an excuse for why they could treat the prisoners that we had, the alleged terrorists at Guantanamo Bay, the way we did. So these Lincoln set tons of horrible precedents, and it shattered the consent of the government forever. And most people don't realize that before the Civil War, before the war between the states, the United States, when people talked about the United States, they talked about it in plural terms. They would say the United States are a great place to live. And after the war, it became singular. The United States is.
Right. Yeah, this is interesting, isn't it? Because the idea is that the independent states, they're only really independent if they can take a vote to secede from Washington and just leave, if they feel like it. And I sometimes hear rumors that maybe one state, mostly the one that crops up is Texas, might actually do that one day.
Yeah, well, we still talk about it. And I would love to. We in America, I think you, to a great degree, England is the same. All the majority white countries are in kind of the same position because of the non-white migration and the clash of cultures. And you're certainly seeing it over there with what's happening. And we had last year where you had the angry people out in the streets and your official over there threatened to arrest Elon Musk and all. I don't know what happened. I guess the protests went away, but that's what happens here, where we don't see any kinds of protests. But we are completely divided culturally. We have millions of people who, no matter how many movies Hollywood tells them to, or liberal politicians, how many teachers tell them, we're never going to believe that there's anything other than men and women. We're not going to believe there's 57 genders. We're not going to believe that somebody can change their pronouns to they, them. And you've got millions of Americans now that believe that.
So there you go, Don Jeffries. Put the full version of that interview up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. Fantastic writer, I think. But what about his verdict on Lincoln? Absolutely unforgiving.
Well, it's always interesting to hear what US people think about their own culture. I think that's a fairly partial and tendentious account of what went on in the Civil War. And of course, the whole idea...
So are you more with the Union than the Confederacy?
Well, I wasn't alive, Tony.
No, I know. But what do you know? What do you make of the rights and wrongs of that Civil War?
Listen, Karl Marx, for example, was solidly in support of the Union, as was Engels.
In support of Lincoln?
Yeah.
So hence you don't...
Well,
you
I mean, if I was around in those days... And the thing about history from the past like that is you can say, well, I would be on this side or that side. The fact is you weren't there, and you're not there now, because it all happened.
This is a really specious argument, isn't it?
No.
The idea that because you're not there, you can't anything to say about it.
What you should be able to do, Tony...
What he's doing is he's written a book about it, hasn't he? That's a rather good thing to do.
You should be able to analyse all of it objectively. Now, I haven't read his book.
Well, he's saying that the more you look into Lincoln, the worse he gets. So how can you be
according to him?
How can you be objective about that?
Well, that's his opinion.
But we don't have to all be objective when writing books, Martin.
Right, okay,
I think you know that.
He doesn't like Lincoln. He didn't like FDR. He doesn't like Lincoln.
He's saying that the more evidence you look into, the worse a guy he is.
Okay.
Anyway, so he doesn't agree with Marx. So you don't agree with him.
Karl Marx was very much in favour of the Union, yeah.
Anyway, he also talks about much more modern stuff and up-to-date stuff in this longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. But before we hear from him talking about the modern journalism, let's have a quick listen to Adam Curtis, what he's has to say in the UK. He's a TV documentary maker. I haven't seen much from him for ages. I remember the last article I ever did for RT before they stopped using my articles was about his a review of his documentary Bitter Lake, which I thought was a fascinating documentary. But he's famous for things like The Mayfair Set, The Century of the Self, brilliant filmmaker. And here he is talking about the rise and fall of the TV journalist.
Well, we seem to have lost the art.
This is a short and possibly unfair history of the rise and fall of the television journalist as a hero. If you go back 50 years, television journalists were creeps, above all to politicians. They followed the rule of their boss, Lord Reith. The BBC, he said, is for the people. The government is for the people, so it follows that the BBC must be for the government.
Well now, Mr. Eden, with your very considerable experience of foreign affairs, it's quite obvious that I should start by asking you something about the international situation today, or perhaps you would prefer to talk about home. When shall it be?
With the questioning of authority in the 1960s, this began to change. But it was Watergate that transformed everything. Two journalists, Woodward and Bernstein, exposed corruption at the highest level of the US government. And suddenly, television journalists realized what they had been born to do. To expose the dark heart of government, big business and bureaucracy. It was the start of a heroic age in which television journalists revealed the sinister forces that we couldn't see and those in power wanted to hide from us. Out of it came much great journalism. But then an event happened that made it clear that despite their heroic confidence, the journalists didn't know everything. The Berlin Wall suddenly collapsed. It was one of the biggest events of the 20th century, and none of them had seen it coming.
Mm-hmm. Here is a brick from the Berlin Wall, a souvenir from your trip here.
Jens Reich, look at it and tell us what you think tonight.
With the end of the Cold War, the TV journalists were thrown into a new and terrifying world, where all the old certainties of good and bad, right and left, began to blur in an unnerving way. And it destroyed their ability to tell us their simple moral fables. So as a way out, they came up with a new theory. They had actually been patronizing and elitist when they had lectured us about corruption in high places. Instead, all stories in future should reflect our experience, and attempts to explain why things happen were abandoned. A classic example was a new type of investigative journalist, Donal McIntyre. He set out to show what it was like to get mugged. He took his mobile phone onto the streets of Brixton. For 3 nights, he desperately tried to get it snatched, until finally, someone gave him his story.
Sir, looking for Stockwell Tube. Yeah? Stockwell Tube. Boom. Oh, fucking hell! Oh, my mobile's gone!
And as Donal cried, we knew that he was sharing our pain. But there was one final step in this transformation of journalism. We cut out the middleman, the journalist.
If you've got a story to tell, we'd love to hear from you. The email address, as always, your news.
Commentators, who are they? Well, they're you.
Now, our presenters plead with us to send in our photos and videos. They proudly present it as a new kind of open democracy. But in reality, it's something very different. Because the journalists don't understand what is going on in today's complex, chaotic world, they have had to revert to their old habit of finding someone in authority who will tell them. But this time, it's not the politicians, it's us, the audience, that they've turned to. The only problem is that we don't have a clue what's going on, particularly because the journalists have given up on their job of explaining the world to us.
So, bless him, Adam Curtis there, taking us on an interesting little journey. Martin, do you think it really is that bad? I think it's about a decade or so old, that. The idea that, journalists and the producers are just fishing around for any old thing, basically, and they're not really checking it. And they're asking people that don't really know anything at all about what's going on.
Well, there's increasingly clear that we're living in a world of infotainment, aren't we? I mean, there used to be a fairly clear distinction between the news programmes and the non-news programmes, the entertainment programmes, but that's increasingly blurred. Curtis, I find a very interesting filmmaker and a very interesting guy, but I often feel after I've watched one of his long magnum opus films, because he's got all the footage in there, because he's got access to all the BBC archives, so he's managed to get loads and loads of really interesting footage. But I often feel at the end of it all that I'm less wise about what's going on than I was at the beginning.
Well, maybe that's because you've realised that you were less wise, rather than you thought you were cleverer than you were.
There's an element of him making it all. Look, for example, there's no straightforward stuff about 9/11 in there with Curtis. Yeah, we know, the dogs in the street know that the state did that. But he will put stuff out saying, well, people started to believe that maybe the state of the government might have done something like that. And that's the way he phrases it all.
Yeah, so we're going to hear
it's
now...
It's all in the mind.
We're going to hear now from Don Jeffries again about journalism generally. Two things, really. There's various bits and bobs in here, but two main ones. This guy, Arbut Dwyer, who was head of the Treasury for one of the United States states, and shot himself on live television to try and make a point, but the point was never made because the journalism wasn't done. And his speech that he'd given before he then shot himself wasn't reported. That was back in 1987. And then much more recently, beginning of this year, Donald Trump is scrapping US aid or USAID. Apparently, as a result of that, 2,600 journalists have lost their jobs.
I talk about things that have been completely forgotten. Like, people would contact me and say, wow, I forgot all about that. And, one of the things I cover is a couple of things I cover. One of them was this guy, Arbut Dwyer, who is the Pennsylvania state treasurer, excuse me, who very memorably, he made headlines by blowing his brains out during a live press conference in 1987. And as I pointed out, every media report at the time said that, they've made it portray this. Well, obviously, this would be crazy to shoot himself at a press conference. And they invariably said he read, after reading a long, rambling statement. Now, they didn't say anything about what was in the long, rambling statement, but I read the long, rambling statement because it was published in a newspaper called The Spotlight, which has been smeared as anti-Semitic. But they're the only ones, and they interviewed his widow as well. The long rambling statement was a detailed indictment against the governor of the state, which was then Richard Thornburgh, who later became George Bush the First, his attorney general. And it was, full of, allegations of incredible corruption on a personal level, just, using things for his family and things like that. And also more serious financial scandals. And Thornburgh went after him and targeted him. and tried to prosecute him as well. And Dwyer thought that by killing himself like that, he would bring attention to it. But he was naive enough, so he didn't understand that we have a completely state-controlled press here in this country. So even though representatives from all different media outlets were there, no one said anything about what he was talking about before he killed himself.
Well, look, you're talking here about George Herbert Walker Bush, the first Bush.
Yes.
Bush Sr.
Yes.
I mean, he was ex-CIA director, wasn't he?
Absolutely, yeah.
The CIA, which is protecting him, which is a very strong influence on the mass media through Operation Mockingbird and things like this. I mean, as an ex-mass media person myself, I think it'd be worth you saying, you know, just how much actually does get through the mass media in the United States. How do you think things are going over there?
Well, now we have, with Trump has changed the situation so much because he's in the middle of everything now. And everything, you know, Trump's enduring legacy may be the concept of just saying fake news. And it is all fake, but the problem is both sides now use fake news. So if something comes out they don't like from anybody, they just say it's fake. But you mentioned Operation Mockingbird, and one of the most notable disclosure we've had from DOGE so far, the Department of Government Efficiency that Elon Musk was running, when he was looking at USAID, which is really a subsidiary of the CIA, we've discovered now. But one of the things that was in there was that there were 6,200 journalists all over the world, not just American journalists, 6,200 journalists that were on USAID's payroll. They were on the U.S. government's payroll. So to me, that's a massive extension of Operation Mockingbird. So we don't know. And again, that was just kind of glossed over. And we don't know the details on it. Who were these journalists? Yeah. How much were they paid? So the state of the media in this country is just horrible. I mean, I don't believe anything they say. And I've compared the American media to TASS and Pravda at the height of the Soviet Union. I don't think it's any different. The difference is that the Soviet Union back then, they were smart enough and unbrainwashed enough to realize they were being lied to. Yet at least half of America, if not more, are so brainwashed and so stupid, frankly, that they believe that CNN and MSNBC and even most Fox News and New York Times, Washington Post, they believe these are independent outlets that are telling them the truth, and they're just feeding them. Talk about misinformation nonstop. They lie about everything. When the JFK files were released recently, the New York Times, who has never told one word of truth about the JFK assassination over 60 years, they had a headline saying, JFK files release, hint, Oswald still did it. It's like, what? You know, it's like, that's where we're at.
He's pretty damning, isn't he, about the US media? I suppose he's right. If that was a New York Times headline, obviously Oswald didn't do it. But they're just still lying, however many years it is. Is it 60, 70, 60 years after the assassination?
Mm-hmm. Well, there's a story, an anecdote from years ago when a Soviet journalist is coming to the United States, and he's on the plane flying to the United States and sitting next to somebody, and they say, well, who are you? Well, my name's so-and-so, I'm a Russian journalist, and I'm coming to the United States. I say, why are you coming to the United States? I'm coming to study how your propaganda system works. And the person said, well, we haven't got a propaganda system. He said, that's what I'm coming to study.
Yes, because you don't think it's there. Yeah, okay, brilliant. Now let's have a look at I think I've got another couple of clips of those which I think I'll play next week from Don Jeffrey. Such a fascinating guy, and I think fantastic books that will be up on the show page at thisweek.org.uk. I'm not particularly bothered whether you're a Confederate or a Union person. I just want to know what was going on, because it certainly wasn't really about slavery. It was much more going on in the American Civil War. Seems very much orchestrated to me in order to concentrate power in Washington, which is what it ended up doing. So there is also this week, I think, it's only just out. It's a It's a documentary about, or extended interview, actually, about Palantir, Martin. Now, this is quite a powerful company, both in civil society and in the military sectors. The point here, really, I suppose, is picking up on our interview a couple of weeks ago about IBM. Now, computer companies can be extremely powerful, and we'll hear from you after this, Martin, but let's have a listen now to the first few minutes of this interview with Juan Sebastian Pinto, who's a whistleblower from within the tech company Palantir, which is using AI to run wars and also governments.
It's one thing to criticize your former employer. It's taboo to do that. But to criticize an employer that also owns extremely lethal technologies and surveillance technologies that are highly invasive and used in war zones is something else entirely.
It's 2025. We're all kind of used to government surveillance. The idea that we're all being watched all the time and don't own our own personal data has become normalized. We're also used to the military spending vast amounts of our money on just a few giant defense contractors. But one tech company wants to change both of those things
and become the ultimate military contractor and the ultimate arbiter of all of our data.
Palantir is here to disrupt and make the institutions we partner with the very best in the world, and when it's necessary, to scare our enemies and on occasion kill them.
Check out Palantir shares surging 22% after the company cited a boom in demand for its AI software from the U.S. government.
We're doing it. We're doing it. And I'm sure you're enjoying this as much as I am.
Palantir, a tech company based here in Denver, claims they can revolutionize government systems with their data analysis software, newly powered by artificial intelligence. They've been hired by the Department of Defense, the FBI, local police departments, and even the IRS and Wendy's to take in the information those organizations collect even more information, and use that data to draw conclusions.
It can be used to completely reconfigure organizations' ontology, its reality, what systems matter, what information matters, what processes matter, how they are structured, what biases are introduced at each of those stages.
We talked to a former Palantir employee, dug into decades of research, and listened to hours of Alex Karp's own words to unwrap the layers of Palantir's carefully cultivated sales pitch, how they capitalize on fear, uncertainty, and unrest.
I don't think in win-lose, I think in domination. This is a company built for bad times. Bad times mean strong finances internally. Bad times are very good for Palantir because we built products that are robust, that are built for danger.
Let's rewind a little. Palantir's story starts with one of the most effective things a company can have for sales: fear. After the September 11th attacks, the United States government began expanding surveillance both at home and abroad. This was, of course, a boon for the defense industry at large. Simultaneously, the Silicon Valley tech industry was growing fast and making people in a once obscure industry very, very rich, very, very quickly. Like the founders and executives at PayPal, known as the PayPal Mafia. Elon Musk, Reid Hoffman, the LinkedIn guy, and Peter Thiel. When PayPal was sold, Thiel had millions of dollars burning a hole in his pocket and an idea. PayPal had developed systems for detecting fraud and crimes on the platform. What if they could use similar thinking to analyze the world at large? So Thiel pulled from his network to build out a new company. One of the first hires was Thiel's Stanford Law School roommate, Alex Karp, who'd gone on after Stanford to get a PhD in not business or computer science or engineering, but neoclassical social theory. They named the company Palantir, after the Palantiri from J.R.R. Tolkien's Lord of the Rings.
In Lord of the Rings, the Palantir Stone is a magical object that allows its users to predict the future or to see what's going on in a remote location.
It was originally created by the elves. It was meant to be used for good purposes. It is potentially a very dangerous technology. It's very powerful.
Long have you hunted me.
So that's Middle Earth, but what does Palantir do in a regular Earth?
What we do is we use what
legal scholars call a predicate-based search. So we would look at you, and then we would go out and say, oh, there's lots of different things in your life that may be indicative of someone involved in bad behavior.
Put simpler, they make software that makes it easier for their customers to collect and analyze data, and then act on that analysis with and without AI. By 2013, 10 years after their founding, Palantir's client list included the FBI, the CIA, the NSA, the Marines, the Air Force, Special Operations Command, and more.
Did your company help to track and kill Osama bin Laden?
You know, we can never... I'll tell you, the closest thing to an answer is like there are... When you look at the... like. When you open the paper and look in the news about these kind of things, there's a 2/3 chance, depending on the country involved, that somehow my company was involved.
Fundamentally, the mission that is pushed to employees is that we're solving the world's hardest problems and supporting Western institutions. That is the main driver of sort of this militaristic culture that is developed inside of Palantir.
If you do not feel comfortable supporting the legitimate efforts of America and its allies in the context of war, don't join Palantir.
This entire message of, like, we are the most lethal, we are the most able to surveil and process large amounts of data.
You have created the system which you call kill chain.
Privately. Publicly, the lawyers have some innocuous something like tech for the amelioration of unwanted blah, blah, blah. Some term we're supposed to use.
Okay, let's...
For me, it's the kill chain.
Kill chain sounds good.
Kill chain isn't an original term created by Palantir. It's the more general military verbiage for the series of decisions leading from identifying a target to taking their life. Palantir's contract added their software and artificial intelligence to the kill chain.
It's quicker and better and safer and more violent.
It's tech that Juan helped market.
It reduces the distance you have to the problem, but when you're able to take a step back and really see all the narratives and how they were shaped and the actual application of these technologies, your whole world starts falling apart, which is something that, you know, definitely happened to me.
So the problem is the person who's alive when it comes to Palantir, who's not productive enough, or, you know, this is a bit like Stalin, isn't it? No person, no problem.
Well, yes, I mean, obviously, we're very aware of the power of these people at the moment because they've got the ear of Donald Trump. And they are very much in the driving seat of policy as we speak.
Well, they've certainly sort of piggybacked on Trump in order to help him get to power. But he's now semi-ditched Musk, hasn't he? So he's no longer head of the Doge. He's Trump has given him the elbow. Unless he's just said to Trump, "Oh yeah, I've done everything I can."
Well, the problem for Elon
is
Musk
Trump using it. You know, Trump may be using these people.
Listen, what people are becoming aware of is how disorganized the Trump administration is. There are various factions who have just gradually formed, and they're all at each other's throats, so that nobody knows who's in charge or what the policy is.
Well, we know it wasn't working very well before, was it?
Well, no, the whole system.
Even
in the United
States. Just a bit of disruption. In fact, that's what Carp and the rest of them love.
Yes, that's right, because they believe in creative destruction, and if you smash everything up, then good things happen.
Move fast and break things. Yeah.
Instead of move slow and fix things. No, move fast and break things. But of course,
anarcho-capitalism.
Yes, and Elon Musk, of course, speaking of anarcho-capitalism, Tesla's profits have gone right through the floor because it's not his fault.
Everyone's realizing that this is a rather rubbishy technology.
That's right. So in other words, he's actually, I mean, I thought it was quite ridiculous of him to be a member of the government anyway. Aren't you supposed to be this entrepreneur that's running all these companies? Who's doing that while you're running the government? And of course, he's now had to go back and
it's just money, isn't it? It's money.
Yes.
And the money for Tesla was predicated on this whole idea that electric cars were going to be a thing. And the government and people like Millibrain have made sure that they are a thing by subsidizing them. So in a way, what they're doing is they're just using government to subsidize some kind of new technology, whether it's good or not. They don't really care, to make money.
Yes, because that's what they do.
And that's the next bubble.
Well, yes, it is a bubble and it's going to crash. And of course, in actual fact,
no, bubbles burst.
Well, all right.
The Tesla cars might crash, but the bubbles will burst.
Yes, and of course, ultimately, the Chinese are stealing everybody's lunch because they're the ones who are building electric cars, which are actually affordable. That's why we can't have them.
So the film is called Palantir, The New Deep State. Is that the right sort of term, do you think, to use for them?
Well, they are. They're definitely embedded in the military-industrial complex. And, of course, the CIA have been... You know, the level of manipulation of Western populations by the military-industrial complex is absolutely incredible. Just think about the billions that are spent every week on, fighting
these
wars.
This is what happens, right? As we were talking...
Brainwashing people and so on.
Earlier on about loads of useless sycophants being appointed to power. Is these useless sycophants, one of the great things about them is you can convince them that a whole load of junk is what everyone should spend all their money on and all the government should believe in. So this is how we've come to the situation where the decision-making processes in our democracy, so-called, are so rubbish. I suppose... sitting around the table are all of the fascist business leaders, the BlackRock owners and the people that own the world, rubbing their hands.
They are, but there are tensions within the ruling class between different factions who've got different interests. So they squabble amongst themselves. You can see that the level of competence of the leadership in Russia and China is just far higher than the level of competence in the West. And that's partly because they've got a more authoritarian setup. Stupid people don't get promoted and all of that. But there's an infantilism going on in the West. We were talking earlier. Why do you presume that stupid people know anything? You've got to let them have their say and all this.
But isn't this because those at the top cannot bear to hear criticism of their own point of view to such an extent that they're prepared to stamp on people with an opposite point of view? In fact, what we're seeing now in terms of that bringing itself to light in Britain is the ridiculous arrests of journalists who are trying to stop genocide. I mean, this is the idea. The idea is that it's not that we don't control things enough, is that we cannot bear to have anybody who is making us look stupid. But even though we are stupid, we don't want anyone to be allowed to say we are. It's like the Emperor's new clothes.
Well, it is. And of course, in a way, them persecuting people like Richard Medhurst and the others, David Miller and so on, it wakens up a certain proportion of the population that, you know, we're being led by the nose here to potential nuclear catastrophe.
Mm. Yeah. Well, anyway, let's hope there's no serious problems over in India, Pakistan, because that's one I think that the Western world has been attempting to brew up for years, making sure both these powers, first of all, and the partition of India, were at each other's throats and now are nuclear armed. So it seems to me as if this is just the same old neo-colonial, let's let the fuzzy wuzzies fight it out, even if they've got nukes.
Well, that's right. I mean, underlying all of this is the US, the determination of the US deep state to try and smash China, basically. They don't want to. The Chinese cannot smash China.
No, they could, forget it, mate.
But they can destroy the whole world in an attempt to do so.
Mm.
That's the danger. And of course, there are so many flashpoints now.
Yeah. There are, aren't there?
There's so many different flashpoints now.
So we've got a couple of items before we close. One is listening to the Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. We don't hear quite enough of him, but he's been up to interesting stuff, isn't it? They've now got a new treaty, the Russians, with the Iranians, Martin, haven't they?
That's right, and it's some aspects of it are secret.
Forced by the Americans, really, and the American bullying of Iran and the Europeans bullying of Russia. Anyway, let's have a listen to Lavrov, and you can have your say when we've heard from him.
One of the pressing issues we discussed today was the task of countering illegal, destructive, unilateral coercive sanctions. These sanctions not only create problems to the countries they are imposed on, but also create even greater problems to those imposing them and for international trade. as they sharply restrict the freedom of competition and violate the principles on which the World Trade Organization and other structures serving the global economy are based. We agreed to continue detailed work on all these issues, both politically at the UN and other multilateral platforms, and bilaterally, in order to mitigate and eliminate the effect of these illegal sanctions. We are fully confident that we will be able to do this. We agreed to increase cooperation within the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, BRICS, and discuss the theme of the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, on the Iranian nuclear program. We have a unified stance that the U.S.'s withdrawal from this plan in 2019 played a very negative role in the overall atmosphere of negotiations. Nevertheless, we welcomed efforts, as far as we can assess, to reach objective, mutually acceptable agreements, including those being discussed between the Islamic Republic of Iran and the United States. Russia is certainly ready to assist in this process and will fully support agreements that take into account the legitimate interests of the Islamic Republic of Iran. We also exchange views on other international political issues, including the situation in Palestinian territories, which causes deep concern, as well as developments in the Syrian Arab Republic after the change of government in December, and generally in the Middle East.
Well, I mean, you know, Lavrov is super.
Shame he doesn't talk in English. He doesn't. Shame he doesn't speak in English more. Apparently, Putin can speak English, but yeah, they are. They are absolutely looking at all of the countries that the West is trying to bully, and realizing, okay, there's a good strategic partnership here. Let's make sure that we buy stuff from them, and they buy stuff from us, and we, you know, we make sure that the sanctions don't mean anything.
Well, I think the thing is, he wants the sanctions on Iran lifted. Because, of course, there was an agreement to lift sanctions on Iran, provided they didn't have nuclear weapons. I mean, Trump ripped that up.
So, on to sport now. You don't often hear that being said on here. And here we have a chap called Ben Wollaston, who's number 40-something in world snooker. And here he is on Wednesday, just taking a few shots against his opponent, who's Mark Selby. But some very interesting chit-chat amongst the commentators on BBC.
Yeah, very controlled. I seem to remember reading an interview, I think, where Ben was talking about
62.
After what he feels was the COVID jab, and then he immediately feeling
63.
Unusual, that his hand was shaking a lot, and I hadn't seen him play since then, but no sign of that now. That's good. Looks rock solid on the shot.
70.
Yes, his hands do look steady. You remember when we had 71. The jab, they'd say to you, can you please stick around for 5 minutes or 10 minutes and make sure you feel okay? And it was in that 5 or 10 minutes he either fainted or collapsed. It was one of the two. Then he felt fine and he went home. And he collapsed again. So in the immediate aftermath of his jab, he collapsed twice.
75.
And ever since then, it's been a very, very gradual 77. Up and down return to full health. And I know there are certain weeks where, in the early days, he couldn't practice more than an hour a day because it would be so exhausting. I think he's learnt to manage that. Still has periods, if he's feeling tired, where it comes back a little bit. But by and large, touch wood, he is healthy again. And that's the reason why he's made it back to the Crucible for the first time in 12 years. And it's been a bit of a journey.
So for several months, the 37-year-old struggled with the most basic tasks after he'd had his COVID jab, such as standing or even staying awake for any length of time. Despite all these health challenges, which still remain undiagnosed, I think we can all diagnose them right here and now. This is Ben Wollaston. He admirably managed to maintain his status on the tour, so he's back. But it was quite interesting to hear that on the commentary, a little bit of background about someone basically who just had a COVID jab, immediately keeled over, and it's taken him since 2021 to actually get back into the circuit. So that's 4 years, basically. I mean, I think they said longer than that, but that's because he'd been out because he just wasn't good enough. But now he is, and he's back.
Well, obviously, I don't know the exact details of his life history. I do read stuff on...
Well, I'm not really asking you about the details of his life history.
No, we're talking about COVID jabs.
Yeah. Well, and it's about vaccine
John
injuries.
John Campbell, people follow him. He's been following all this up. The only point I would make about this, mRNA jabs were not used in China or Russia at all. Nobody had one.
Well, I'm not so sure about that. I think you're right that some of them were old-fashioned type vaccines where they just take the thing and then they denude it. But anyway, it's funny you mentioned Dr. John Campbell because I've got him as our final item this evening. Here he is talking to Dr. David Nutt. Now, do you know who Dr. David Nutt is?
Yeah, he used to be head of the British government's drugs policy, but they got rid of him because they didn't like what he had to say.
Was he being a bit sensible, by any chance?
Yes, I would say he was being
sensible.
Well,
let's have a listen. Let's see how sensible Dr. David Nutt is. He's unforgettable, really, as the guy who's the chief drug advisor to the British government. And here he is talking to Dr. John Campbell a couple of days ago.
So I can remember as a child, hippies, and there was a lot of talk about LSD and various psychedelics. But then it seemed to go really fairly quiet. I mean, I was born in 57, so I'm probably talking about the 60s. I had this peripheral awareness of this. Mm-hmm. And looking back, well, being reminded from your book, there was some pretty successful psychedelics being used in psychiatry in the late 40s, early 50s? Certainly a lot in the late 50s.
In the late 50s, yes. I mean, I think it was about 53 that Sandoz made available LSD for research, particularly in psychiatry. And I think in 57, the famous man who, Albert Hoffman, who discovered LSD, he made LSD. He then got access to magic mushrooms and then worked out that the active ingredient in magic mushrooms was called psilocybin. And Sandoz made that available. It was called indocybin. So there were basically two medicines. LSD was called Delicid and psilocybin was called indocybin. And they made it available to researchers in most Western countries, in fact. And it was, and in those days, there weren't any psychiatric treatments. The drugs you mentioned earlier, chlorpromazine, wasn't really being rolled out to the late 50s, and imipramine and antidepressants later. So these drugs were the first true treatments in psychiatry, and psychiatrists thought they were really very, very powerful and effective. But then they moved out of medicine into what you alluded to, sort of became part of the hippie culture. And the hippie culture was anti the Vietnam War. Mm. And the American government was very pro the Vietnam War. And when hippies were putting up placards saying, "Drop acid, not bombs," that was seen as a terrifying threat to the U.S. establishment. And they couldn't ban protests, but they could ban the drugs. So they banned the drug. They banned LSD. And then he thought, well, there's other drugs like LSD, psilocybin, DMT. We'll ban those. So even though there was no suggestion that these were about either harmful or even fueling protests. So the drugs got banned by the U.S. in 1968. We followed suit, as we always do, when the Americans say, "Jump, you say, how high, sir." And then in 71, the UN banned them. And they're still banned. They've been banned ever since. Yeah. It's impossible to work with them. And I think that's the worst censorship of research and clinical therapy in the history of the world. 55 years. Drugs which could transform people's lives for depression, PTSD, addictions, they've been banned simply because the American government thought they were actually fueling an anti-war protest.
Our generation, isn't it? You think of the mental distress I've had in times in my life. Could that have been attenuated, ameliorated? You know, mental distress I've seen in those around me.
Very likely, John. I think that's a very important point to make, that I'll make it in slightly different ways. But it wasn't just that these drugs were the first psychiatric medicines. They were also powerful and enduring. So, you know, you didn't need many, you know, one or two trips could give you a very, very long-lasting effect, maybe a lifetime. And then, of course, there's the other ways of using them. So Hoffman lived to 102. And he used what we would call a sort of mini or a micro dose of LSD on a regular basis to keep his brain active and functioning. And the first British psychiatrist to use LSD was a man called Joel Elkies. He was professor in Birmingham in 1953. And he took LSD, and he wrote about the experience and said, I think I know how it works. And he lived to 103, so it's quite possible that if we use these drugs sensibly like the early guys did, they could have given us resilience and longevity too, as well as help treating mental illness.
Well, this is all very interesting, isn't it? But we all know that the actual reality of the drugs industry as it's developed is essentially criminalised cartels.
Wasn't that the point in banning some of these substances, yes, in prohibiting them, is that actually you can make a lot more money through supplying them in a black market?
Well, you can, and of course it's a way of controlling the population as well. So, you know, the crack cocaine epidemics in the 1980s in major US cities were orchestrated by the CIA in order to fund the Contras. And, of course, LSD leaked out of being used in psychiatric treatments into, you know, recreational use in California. And, of course, there's no rationality. But they're having a sensible adult discussion about the use of psychedelic drugs. The real problem we're facing is that drugs are ubiquitous.
I mean, aren't they being a bit flippant there, though? Because these drugs can completely destroy someone's brain. Well, I mean, we all know about
like
acid. Yeah, everyone, pretty much, most people know about acid casualties. Someone who's had their life wrecked by this LSD.
The thing is, making it illegal doesn't resolve any of the issues around it. People are going to do it anyway. They're going to do all sorts of things anyway. And making it illegal means you can't do it under controlled circumstances with the best
opportunity. Isn't that sort of a warning to the public? Look, if you do this, then either you're going to be committing a crime or you're going to be doing something stupid.
Well, look, I'm against prohibition. I'm against prohibition on humanistic grounds.
So what do you think? LSD should be available like sweets, should it?
I didn't say that, Tony.
But what do you mean, then?
In Portugal, since the early 2000s, all possession of any kind of drug is a decriminalised offence. So that means that the police don't waste any time arresting people for possession for personal use of anything. What you need to do is educate people about what's safe and what's not safe. And, of course, electricity is dangerous, yeah? Very dangerous. Maybe it should be banned because people get electrocuted all the time. We don't need any electricity. I think the thing about drugs, all drugs, is they're not necessarily good for you. Some of them are mind expanding. Some of them aren't.
Incredibly addictive.
And making them illegal doesn't solve any problems at all.
Very, very addictive, aren't they?
Some are. Alcohol, for example. Cigarettes, both of which are legal. Very addictive.
Yeah, and I think the other thing is that the police don't really seem to make any efforts in really keeping these drugs off the streets. It's part of the police are getting paid off by the dealers often.
Tony, I think,
and the policy is not to anyway. I mean, they
can't do it. An illegal market with super profits is unstoppable. You take some one person out. It's happening
crystal
in
meth,
Mexico
the
now.
Police take a very serious attitude to. If crystal meth is circulating here in Bristol, as I understand it, you will find the police are absolutely on it straight away.
They're hoping to stop it taking a hold here. But, of course, in the United States, it already has taken a hold.
Not Britain, is it, in
no,
the United States? It might become like that here.
Well, yes,
it's
will.
Just a question of finding the right copper to pay off, isn't it?
Well, it can be. Because the super profits are massive. The 'Ndrangheta in the Camorra in Italy are absolutely embedded in the state.
So why do we bother having a police if people can just do these crimes and no one really cares?
Maybe we should have anarchism, Tony. No police and everybody do the drugs they want. Ah, well, there you are.
It's not about drugs, about murder too, yeah?
Yes, okay. Yes,
so no law?
No, well...
You're going to quite an extreme point here.
No, I'm just trying to reduce your argument to absurdity. The reason why
absurd.
They cannot stop the drinking...
It's not absurd to make sure that there is no access for children to LSD like sweets in a sweet shop.
Nobody's suggesting there should be, Tony, but we still need to legalise drugs or decriminalise them in the first place, because otherwise, places like Mexico and in Colombia, the left-wing governments are moving towards decriminalisation and also legalization, because people are dying every day, being killed every day about the money. And you can get rid of that by regularizing the market. And if you don't do that, the banking system, of course, is totally dependent on dirty drug money. Maybe we don't need banks. Just get rid of banks and go back to barter.
Well, I think we just need to have at least some sort of decision about whether we want this or not, and not just give up and say, oh, well, people can just do whatever they want.
On Easter Sunday, there was a big protest in Castle Park. It was kids demanding the legalisation of cannabis.
Well, that is surely acceptable.
Well, it was an illegal protest. And there were thousands of them there, and they made a lot of mess. There was a lot of rubbish to clear up by the council.
I mean, the police actually do acknowledge that this is going on. They're not pretending, but they were being very uncooperative, apparently, at the weekend here in central Bristol. The point is that the police, even themselves, have opened up places where people can take their drugs here in Bristol city centre to see if they have been watered down or diluted. They've done that in Glasgow as well. The police have got this, on the one hand, an enlightened attitude, and on the other hand, they just don't want to think about it, and they're not talking
the
to
is that the society,
people who are trying to actually get this debate going. The police are ignoring them.
The society as a whole is dominated by mainstream propaganda, which makes it almost impossible to have a sensible conversation about any of this. Yeah, we're not allowed to have one.
Well, we are having one. I hope it's a sensible conversation.
And
so were they just now.
Yes, I know, but I mean, what you're going to find if you read the Daily Mail is you're not going to get a sensible conversation.
Well, maybe
most people
just don't read the Daily Mail.
Well, I know I don't,
Tony.
Maybe
you can read the Daily Mirror.
Yes, well, I mean, even in the Mirror, the attitudes toward these things are very, very difficult for people to change. It's a very complicated issue. And underlying all of this is the illegality of it in creating massive funds, which then people fight over.
The headlines that came out this weekend to do with the pro-cannabis event in Castle Park at the weekend over Easter is just about how much rubbish was left around. Now, the people who organised it said, look, we tried to work with the council to make sure that there was some sort of system which we could work with them to make sure the rubbish was all cleared up afterwards. We knew there would be rubbish around. The council refused to talk to them.
That's right.
So they're deliberately trying to make a situation where they can just blame them, saying, oh, it's too messy, we're not going to allow
this. Well, I mean, I think what's interesting is...
There was
lots of people smoking cannabis there. I passed through it on the way somewhere else.
The
police basically didn't bother to try and arrest anybody because, you know, there's just too many.
But anyway, the council said an application for a temporary event notice had been submitted, but they refused it. But it happened anyway. So this is an absurdity, isn't it?
Well, this is the problem, isn't it?
Why are the council bothering to refuse it? Even if they refuse it, it still goes ahead.
You better ask them that. Because it would have been much more...
It's obvious why. It's because they're imbeciles. Well, and they actually cannot... They think they're in control of Bristol, but they're not. It's rather like all the stuff that's been going on at Barton Hill, blocking off everyone's roads and the people around there getting really angry about it and stopping fire engines getting through, stopping ambulances, because they think they're in control of Bristol, but they're actually a bunch of numpties.
Well, people are not necessarily having the power that they think they have in relation to all sorts of things, isn't it? The real world is rather a refractory place.
It certainly is. Anyway, lovely little chit-chat about drugs, some good, some bad, in whatever quantities and the right kind of environments. So that's the way I'll leave the advice about drugs on this show this evening. Thanks very much, Martin. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks very much to Martin Summers, also to David Halpin, to Adil Raja, to Don Jeffries, and also, of course, sound engineer Dave Bazanko. You can download our MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like. Follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips. That is the Palantir interview. Thanks very much, Dave, for that this week. Some people do send me some really good stuff in. Thank you, all of you. Difficult to remember who it is, but please send it in. And that is the best way, generally, on the Telegram channel. And the website is thisweekoneword.org.uk, where you can subscribe to my free weekly newsletter. And by the way, sorry, that hasn't gone out last week. I'll have to send it out tonight. It's sitting there waiting. It will come out. I'm sorry, it's just been over Easter and I've been travelling backwards and forwards and things, so it's a bit late. And this show is repeated at 11 p.m. on Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. and p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream. Do please feel free to make live recordings in case we get nobbled. We've been streaming live on the stream at DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app. If you can restream us live or rebroadcast us this show anywhere, or FM or anywhere else, just let me know and I'll give you a credit. Thanks. And have a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the satanic banksters get you down.
Pulled up by the magnet, believe. Life, some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart, some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine. Into each heart some tears must fall, but someday the sun will shine. Some folks can lose the blues in their hearts, but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in mine.
Into each and every life some rain has got to fall, but too much of that stuff has fallen into mine. And into each heart some tears has got to fall, but I know that someday that sun is bound to shine.
Some folks can lose the blues in their heart,
but when I think of you, another shower starts. Into each life some rain must fall, but too much is falling in
the man is not